It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. Seth Rosenblatt's here from the Parallax. We'll talk Max with Jason Snell from Six Colors. Georgia Dow, the VR queen, is here. Slack selling the Salesforce for $27.5 billion. Could it possibly be worth that much? And does it mean it's the beginning of the end for the bring-your-own productivity tool to work? The future of motion picture theaters. HBO Max makes a play to take over. The end of the Computer Fraud Act. The Supreme Court seems to be moving to overturn it. And then it's bye-bye, Ajit Pai. It's all coming up next on Twit. This Week in Tech comes to you from Twit's LastPass Studios. Securing every access point in your company does not have to be a challenge. LastPass unifies access and authentication to make securing your employees simple and secure, even when they're working remotely. Check out LastPass.com/Twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit, This Week in Tech. Episode 800, recorded Sunday, December 6th, 2020. It's coming from Leo 2. This episode of This Week in Tech is brought to you by Worldwide Technology. Worldwide Technology's Advanced Technology Center is like no other testing and research lab, with more than $500 million of equipment, including OEMs like Dell Technologies. And it's virtual, so you can access it 24/7. To learn more and get insights into all it offers, go to wwt.com/twit. And by Barracuda. Did you know that 91% of all cyber attacks start with an email? To uncover the threats hiding in your Office 365 account, get a secure and free email threat scan at barracuda.com/twit. And by Casper. From award-winning mattresses to pillows, sheets, and duvets, Casper transforms the way we sleep, one snooze at a time. Go to casper.com/twit1 and use the code twit1 for $100 off select mattresses. And by Manscaped, the best in men's below-the-belt grooming. Manscaped offers precision engineering tools for your family jewels. Get 20% off plus free shipping at manscaped.com/twit. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's tech news. We've decked the halls with boughs of plastic holly and fake Yuletide cheer, because there's nothing that cheery. Although I'm really thrilled to get Seth Rosenblatt on, because he's the editor-in-chief of the Parallax. And last time you were on was before your wedding, and you had a internet wedding. Congratulations.
I did. And we are still married, which is great.
It's a good sign. Yes. It was because of COVID, right? I mean, you didn't feel.
Yeah, like... I mean, we she moved in just before COVID shutdowns happened, for all the right reasons, and
timing was good.
Timing was good, and we realized that, you know, we probably should make this serious, given that the world was falling apart, and we put together a small outdoors, socially distant in-person gathering for our families,
and I watched on the stream.
We had about 300 people on the live stream, which was really really special. That was cool.
Yeah. Nice.
Also, it's a hell of a lot cheaper than inviting 300 people to your wedding. So.
Honestly, that's how I'm doing it. From now on, every time I get married, it's going to be streamed. Yeah.
Good. Once a year, you know, why not?
Yeah. Actually, Lisa and I, when we got married, didn't invite anybody. It was just the two of us,
That's the way to do it.
It was a little embarrassing, because we got the package, which included a bartender and a waiter with canapes. And it was just the two of us. So you go, would you like a canapé? No. Would you like a canapé? No. How about you? Would you like, honest to God, I said, okay, God. You can leave. The bartender can leave.
The DJ, just leave the canapes.
The DJ can leave. Yeah, we don't need you. It's just the two of us, frankly.
I actually...
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think that you know, one of the interesting things that's come out of COVID that will have been very positive is that we'll see a lot more live streamed weddings.
Absolutely.
Especially for guests who, you know, are too far or infirm or otherwise unable to attend. And it's really neat. Like Juliana's grandmother, who's in her, you know, mid 90s and can't make it or couldn't make it under any circumstances, was able to watch. And that's really cool that people who are in those situations are able to participate in these life events in a more personal way. And it's sort of stunning to me that it took something as terrible as a, you know, global pandemic to get us to that point. But I think for now, it's going to be here to stay for a long time.
I don't think, actually, if you think about it, it's unusual that for crises to be an inflection point for a new way of being in many respects, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's, sure. you know, mm-hmm. war or famine or COVID. I mean, obviously, you don't want to encourage those things, but it isn't unusual at all. Georgia Dow, you're a psychotherapist. Welcome, Georgia Dow. It's great to have you.
Nice to be here.
You were ill last week. I hope you're feeling better.
Oh, yes, I am. Thank you.
Good. So we rescheduled, but you're doing your therapy. We were just talking before the show over Zoom and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's nice. I think that that's the wonderful thing is that we've opened up to being able to do many things remotely that we had the ability to do, but because there wasn't a need, we weren't doing it. And so I do, like I would say 95% of my sessions are through video, and some of them are still through phone call because people might feel shy or not feel comfortable setting up their camera or, you know, some people have a tech phobia.
Right.
And so they're just using a device. They're worried about being spied upon or being seen.
Is it better with video?
For most of them. It is better with video, right?
You get visual
cues. Like, and I don't get all of the visual cue. Like, I'm missing like feet and hands most of the time, but it's much better. And I think that we can form a bond sooner. I'm more emotive than lots of people. So if you're a very quiet therapist or you don't emote a lot, I think that it becomes more difficult, especially if it's just on the phone, because you're wanting, like, if you don't hear anything, you're wondering,
are they listening?
Did they like that? Yeah. Did they hate that? Did they care? Are they staring off into the space? And that can cause a lot of more anxiety, especially if they're dealing with that.
Also joining us, Jason Snell from sixcolors.com. And I think for our business, Jason, as podcasters, nothing's changed at all.
No, I feel really guilty that I have all my friends whose lives have changed, and I still work in my garage and talk to everybody on the internet.
Exactly.
Yeah. At least I used to be able to come and visit you in person. That was my one time out of the house.
I know.
That's not even possible now.
I kind of miss that. I liked having you come up and seeing us.
It was nice. And congratulations on episode 800.
Oh my God.
800, I know.
I didn't even look. It is 800. That means this is the toll-free episode.
Is that
tinfoil?
Right.
1-800. Dial now. Call on
it's in. The tinfoil episode. Thank you, Seth. So nice of you. Actually, you know, I was thinking, Seth, nobody ever mentions this. Nobody ever mentions this. But if you're a single person and you go into quarantine.
Yes.
It's been now 9-10 months you haven't had sex. That would be hard.
We're all
partnered up. But I'm just thinking, there's nobody to hug, nobody to kiss for 9 or 10 months. That's tough.
Yeah.
It would be tough for me anyway. I don't know. I never even think about that. Does that come up for your patients?
Oh, I have a lot of people that are alone and in a lot of distress because they can't meet anyone in Quebec.
We can't date.
Under lockdown.
Yeah.
They can't date, but if you are single and alone, you are allowed to have one other person come to visit you. That's being allowed.
That's how they do it in Montreal.
Yeah. Because of how difficult it is.
Like, it should be.
This has now been a long time. And just to be hugged, to be touched. And even when you meet them, you're not really even supposed to be hugged and touched. So that we need it. We need to be touched. We actually release neurotransmitters and chemicals when we are feeling touch and hugged and cared about. And you don't get that through a screen, even if you're feeling that affection. It's not the same.
I hugged the Grubhub.
And so the levels of depression are growing.
I hugged the Grubhub guy the other night. It was a little weird, but I needed it.
Yeah. How's he doing?
He's in shock.
Not well.
Anyway, I thank you all for being here and staying healthy and being well. And I think more and more what we're going to talk about over the next 6 months is how the world has changed. For instance, I don't think before COVID-19, Slack was worth $27.7 billion. I think you could even say they may not be worth that now. They lose money every quarter. They have revenue of $234 million, which is up, but not up nearly as much as Teams and Zoom. They're kind of the laggard in the COVID thing. Were you surprised, Jason, when you saw that? Salesforce buying them?
I wasn't, and I think the value, I mean, I don't know about billions. What do I know? 20 billion, 28
yeah,
billion, whatever.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think this is, I was excited about it because I do use Slack. I use it a lot. I've been out on my own, you know, even pre-COVID, like I've been working in my garage for 6 years. The way I collaborate with people is mostly through Slack, and it has a lot of value. I know that they've been attacked by Microsoft because Microsoft has such leverage. If you're an Office 365 user, you can just, or 360 user. I always get those mixed up. I don't know. Is it degrees
365? It's
or
not
every
degrees.
Day of the week?
It's days of the year.
It's
yeah.
days of the year. Okay, yeah. So 365 and a quarter technically, but anyway, Microsoft. they, you know, why spend money on Slack if you already have that? Even if Microsoft Teams isn't as good, it's good enough, right?
Oh, but it's so, beating Slack handily in terms of signups because it's part of the deal, right? A lot of people
aren't
Microsoft 365
users.
Yeah,
and why would you pay for Slack under those circumstances? Right. So I think what's good about this is that maybe it frees Slack up to focus more on their product, because you're right, they have gotten lapped by, not only is Microsoft caught up with them or at least gotten close enough with them, but you look at some of the other stuff that they do. I talk to people who have tried to do audio conferences in Slack. It's not very good. Like, they kind of missed the Zoom opportunity to be the place where everybody gathered for video in their workplaces. So, you know, for Salesforce, it's an interesting purchase, but Slack is important, and I think it adds another chapter to Salesforce's story, talking to their clients, and hopefully it frees the Slack people up to improve their product, because that product does feel like it's sort of stalled and hasn't really done a whole lot in the last 3 or 4 years.
In a way, it's better to be a smaller money loser, because if Microsoft or somebody wanted Zoom, its market cap is $115 billion. It's a little bit bigger of a chunk to bite off, as much as $27.7 billion sounds. Interesting article by Casey Newton in his new website, Platformer. Remember, he left The Verge to start this, kind of like you did, Jason, to start his own solo blogging venture. He points out that Slack was the poster child for worker-centered work tools, even more tools that the workers brought into the company. Used it in small groups, and then eventually it spread to the corporate culture, and that's how Slack got in the door, because people loved it. But now we're kind of in a world where the company decides, and the company's a Microsoft company, so they're, or a Google company, so they're just going to use the tool that they're already buying, in effect. And that's going to be hard for Slack. That's one of the reasons Slack had to sell to somebody with a sales force, if you will.
I do think, though, that one thing about this acquisition, I've seen a lot of people say, well, the free tier of Slack, and there's so many of us who are on free Slack instances, is going to go away because Salesforce is going to want to make money. And, you know, a lot of buyers of companies do stupid things with the business model of the company they buy, and so they might do it. But I feel like that free tier is Slack's best sales pitch, right? That Slack is getting people to like Slack and then go to their bosses and say, you need to buy Slack. So I hope they keep that around. But yeah, I also imagine this is an opportunity for Salesforce to start selling Slack into all of the organizations where Salesforce is already playing. And they can, if anybody can take it to Microsoft, it's probably Salesforce.
They must feel that way. Otherwise, they wouldn't have spent what is a considerable premium on what Slack's value was. Do you, you don't use Slack, Seth, or do you? I don't know.
I mean, I've been forced to for, you know, certain projects that I've worked on and whatever. I mean, I think that if Salesforce winds up fixing Slack so that it works fine when you have more than 4 Chrome tabs open, it would be an enormous.
It's an Electron app. That's part
it
of
is.
The problem. It's just a pig. Yeah, it's just a pig.
It really is. Yeah. I feel very weirdly about Slack because I have enough distractions throughout my day. I don't really need to use it to communicate with a lot of people. I'm not in, you know, an office environment. But I also feel like, you know, people communicate about things on Slack that they feel very comfortable talking about in person which is, you know, great for Slack. It's amazing that they created a product that people are doing that with. It's just really unfortunate that a lot of those things are going to be either work sensitive or personally sensitive, and that Slack is probably not a really good platform for that. You don't want to be talking about super sensitive information in
a place. Is it insecure? Is it considered insecure?
I think it depends on which instance you're using. And last time I looked, I could be wrong about this, but the last I looked, Slack was not end-to-end encrypted, which means that those messages are simply, you know, available either to your employer or possibly, you know, available to be subpoenaed if needed, if you're not in a work environment. So there's all kinds of things.
Didn't even think of that. Yeah.
Yeah, there's all kinds of things that I personally am a little twitchy about. If you'll forgive the reference.
Yeah, you want to not commit to email or Slack anything in writing that you don't want to be subpoenaed because it lives forever. And I didn't even consider that as an issue.
I mean, if you have a PGP key in email, that's fine, right?
But
certainly I advise people who want to talk with me in a Slack instance about something that's sensitive that we go take the conversation to any other platform. I mean, you know, like even Facebook Messenger has its secret conversations, which are end-to-end encrypted. There's just so many more options out there right now. And probably for Slack's developers, they feel that there are so many other options, it's not really something that's worth worrying about.
I'm just thinking about the most famous Slack security flaw, and it really wasn't Slack's fault. It was social engineering of Twitter engineers, that's how all of those Twitter accounts got co-opted, including Joe Biden's, because apparently Slack had, rather Twitter had posted credentials for its God mode in Slack, which was a big mistake. But I haven't followed it since, but I think it was social engineering, right, that got them into the Slack community, and then they found the keys there. Yeah.
But you know, I think that's a really important point. If you, of all the things that you must be doing in Slack, perhaps pinning your super credentials
not good
is less brilliant.
But not good.
What can you do?
It kind of shows how people don't really know what is safe and what isn't safe and what they should put into water that people, you know, if they're, you know, your admin can read your emails. I don't think that people by and large are taught what, you know, this media savvy should be taught in schools so that people are thinking, you know, most people don't know what end-to-end encryption is. People don't know that, you know, when they send an email to someone that someone else might be able to read that and have full access to whatever's happening. And so I think that it's not just people at large's fault.
Boy, you would sure hope that Twitter engineers would have some sense of OPSEC. But you're exactly right, Georgia. Even they probably don't know how to assess the risks. I mean, clearly pinning credentials in a Slack channel is not safe. But maybe they thought it was. Is that your experience, Seth, when you're talking to enterprises? The people who should know better just are not as educated about operational security?
It's challenging. I mean, I think, you know, in Twitter's instance, they just did really well by hiring Peter Zatko, you know, as their new
Mudge is great. Mudge is a great security guy, right?
He of all the people they could have gotten, he really knows his stuff. Whether he's able to influence the culture there so this kind of thing that happened doesn't happen again in the future is, I think, an open question. But I think that's a question that a lot of organizations are facing, especially from the pandemic work-from-home era where, you know, you don't know what your employees are using for their home routers. You don't know who else is on their network. You don't know, you know, what else is going on. My wife, for example, wasn't able to use our printer here because she has a work laptop and she doesn't have permissions to connect it, which is really good.
Yes.
I think. I mean, I told her it's unfortunate that you have to connect to my computer to print, but whatever. There's worse things in life. But I suspect that there's a lot of organizations that don't have that kind of a forethought in their processes because they're just trying to get stuff done because everybody's under the gun these days, and it's so hard just to ensure that your you know, able to come close to making your numbers. So,
and when companies,
it's a real challenge.
When companies do enforce that, I mean, obviously her company is aware of security flaws in HP printers and others, and so mm-hmm. is reluctant to allow her to connect to an unknown device. But I had a caller on the radio show today who was pissed off because his he had video from his Aukey security camera and he couldn't share it. It was downloaded to his Apple Photos and he couldn't share it without giving Aukey permission to access mm-hmm. his Apple Photos. And he was all upset about that. And I said, no, that's a good thing.
Right.
You want a company to have to ask for permission to access your stuff. And if you know... Go ahead.
I don't think that he knew that they weren't if they were just granted permission, they're going to be accessed anyways. I don't think that people really grasp that means that they have access to everything.
No, he called the company. He called Aukey and said, how would you do? And they said, no, we don't want your photos, but you can't access it unless Apple says we
can't access your photos unless we can access your photos. If you want to access your photos.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
That may be the single biggest hurdle in security is just people don't have that mindset. I don't blame them. Nobody wants to have that mindset, but you need to kind of be paranoid.
You do. And it's challenging when the technology is developing at such a rapid clip that you're not even able to stay on top of how things are changing. So things that were true maybe 10 years ago, in some cases aren't true. In other cases, I think are even worse. We see this in so many otherwise benign instances. So, I'm hoping of all things that happens with the Slack acquisition is that Salesforce is able to really force its Slack users to improve the levels of security that they're using and to really consider what they're posting, how they're posting it, which is a challenge because it's in their interest, as the owners of Slack to have people post as much as possible. But I think there really has to be some thought given from software developers and manufacturers into what kinds of things you want people posted. It's not good that people put everything into Gmail. We've seen, time and again that come back to bite politicians and military generals mm-hmm. and all sorts of people, in the behind. So it's not technology isn't for everything. It's not your side brain. It's not where you should be dumping everything that you can't keep track of at the moment.
But let's be honest, like our brains are not that good at keeping the information in the first place. We want to be able to have a place where it can exist and we don't have to worry about it being forgotten or lost or have an easy way to remember it. And so dealing with passwords, you could have one password or something else that would then be a safer way to do it. But a lot of people would feel stressed out just putting onto one password and then... Mm-hmm. You might feel comfortable with, say, your Ring doorbell, and then they get bought out with another company and everything changes. And are you going to change your doorbell once it's hooked up now? So it's really hard because reading through these privacy policies and figuring everything out isn't an easy thing if you're not already tech-minded.
I think even if you're tech-minded, reading through privacy policies is a real
unpleasant
experience.
I do it.
You do that, Georgia? Horrible. You read those?
I read them. Oh, I will read them. I don't even understand them all, but especially like stuff that I'm like, it seems sketchy. I will read through it and I'll be then. And almost 100% of the time, it'll come to a point where I'm like, oh, and they're going to snoop through every... And I'm like, okay, no, I won't. And sometimes I'll read through it and I'll be like, you know what? I really want to play Plants vs. Zombies 2 anyways. And so, fine, take it all.
Yeah.
Right. And I sold my soul to,
What complicates it, of course, is that we're not lawyers. And a lot of times the stuff that's put in there is put in there as legal boilerplate. And we read it as a normal human and say, oh, my God. They say they reserve rights in all forms of media, invented or not invented, for the rest of the eternity. I can't agree to that, and it's just typical legalese, and it's not something as bad or as onerous as it sounds. But
it
could be.
Right?
I guess it could be.
They could choose to use it, right? Yeah, Facebook could say, you know what, we're going to be using your picture as an ad campaign. Yeah. You've already given us permission by doing it, and. Are you going to be able to even fight them?
No.
You know, and I think one of the solutions, one of the partial solutions to the problem, is really going to wind up being a national privacy policy law.
Yeah.
And California's taken some very interesting steps, and you know, that push it much more in line with Canada and the EU. And I think it's really going to happen at some point in the Biden administration. I don't know if he's going to support it, but I think that, you know, tech companies are going to be so frustrated in dealing with this, you know, multi-prong approach to privacy, that they just want to have one standard. And, you know, if California's law looks a lot like Europe's law, there's a really good chance that the rest of the U.S. is going to go in that direction as well.
There's kind of a sneaky thing that happens, too. Jason and I are California voters. The ballot proposition that we voted on in November, which passed, to even strengthen the California Privacy Act, was actually kind of written by Facebook.
Yeah.
It looked good, and it seemed like it strengthened, but there were these weird loopholes.
So I wrote about this, and I'm actually doing a piece, a follow-up piece for a non-tech publisher, which is kind of exciting because it's so rare to get an opportunity to talk about these very deep in the woods tech issues for non-tech audiences. But Prop 24 does some really interesting things. It creates a California government agency similar to the FTC to regulate this stuff, and they gave them a budget that is large, that is almost the same size as the budget that the FTC has for regulating this stuff.
Wow.
So California alone will have a $10 million budget to be looking at these issues. It did change the minimum threshold for ultimately what is a violation of the law in a data breach, which is 100,000 users, which is up from 50,000. But it also means that, you know, these companies could potentially be exposed to legal action, possibly class action suits, possibly individual suits, you know, in situations where you know, they were breached and they didn't protect their consumers' data. It's revolutionary in California and in the U.S. But
the thing that was controversial was, besides the giveaways to the big companies, the feeling was, well, Facebook can afford to comply, but what it does is kind of pulls up the ladder for smaller companies. It makes it very hard for them to compete with Facebook. So it had this kind of inverse.
It was a very confusing law. Yeah. The way that the bill was written, it was not particularly clear. I was even a little weirded out, and I asked one of my sources for the story about this, about the fact that it physically looked, or visually looked, the PDF looked sort of off. And they said, yeah, it looks like it's been photocopied 5 times and then scanned in as a PDF. And I said, oh, good. This isn't just me that is sort of unnerved by that.
Yeah.
The other thing to keep in mind is that while the California privacy law that was passed that created this, you know, this tougher regime in the first place in 2018 didn't take effect until January 1st of this year, they didn't even finish, you know, delineating a lot of the nuances of it until September, which means that the law had been in effect for, you know, 9 months. And then they sort of kind of finished it, but still haven't really. And there's a very good chance that that's going to happen with the CPRA, which is this law that Prop 24 codified. So it's going to be a while before things start to get settled in California privacy, but this is a step in the right direction.
It's probably better to do something rather than nothing. The other thing that was a little controversial was companies could pay or allow businesses to create pay for privacy schemes so that if you could afford it, you could be private. You'd pay Facebook $1.50 a month or whatever, and then they wouldn't use your information. Actually, I'm not against
that. Great for them.
Yeah, I'm not against it.
They can make even more money off of you.
But it certainly doesn't seem like privacy should be a luxury item. Like, that should be the default.
No.
But at the same time, I understand that Facebook has costs. This is the is the conundrum.
Oh, come on, Leo.
But they're providing a free service.
But they can find another way to monetize it. That's not
one
my
way. Would
fault.
Be to charge, but, right?
So they can charge, and then they lose their. They don't want to charge, right? That's the thing is that they don't want to charge because they're making more money off of selling off our privacy. So they end up getting their cake and eating it too. Right. That it's like the phone book. You have to pay not to be in a part of.
I know
the phone
that's
book.
Dopey, isn't it?
You know.
Yeah.
It's the same thing, right? Yeah. We're going to sell off everything that you do and be able to make money off of that. And we're going to be able to go against laws that we've said that we're going to say, oh, we're not going to, you know, two click. And this is not all going to be, you know, linked to where you are and then do it anyways, and then get a small slap on the wrist that isn't going to bother us. Or you can pay us money not to abuse your privacy. That seems.
Did you deal with this, Jason, when you were voting? I presume I ended up voting for it. Prop 24, but yeah. I was very mixed. I
voted against it, and I voted against it mostly because our privacy restrictions that went through California's legislature are very recent, and I kind of want to see.
Yeah.
I'm really suspicious when we have a brand new law that's taking effect, and we don't really know how it's going to go, and then all of a sudden there's a ballot measure that wants to tweak it in some way, because it feels to me like maybe we should watch this work and then everybody should learn. And I get real suspicious at that point that maybe this is industry trying to quickly knock out the things that they don't want to have in there. So I voted against it. I'm for more protection, but it did seem a little bit iffy. And I always figured, you know, you can come back next year and fix it if we don't like it this year.
You also had weird groups opposing it, like the ACLU opposed it.
Yeah.
The Republicans opposed it, but so did the Green Party and the Libertarian Party. It's like kind of, I think that this was one of those cases. It was created by Alistair McTaggart, who is a real estate guy in San Francisco who proposed the original ballot proposition that the legislature jumped in and said, no. If we pass a bill, will you yank this? This was 2 years ago. He said, all right, but pass that bill. And they did. I don't think he talks like that, but he should with a name like Alistair McTaggart. He said, all right. And they passed it. But then he came back and said, but I'm going to do it anyway. And that's, by the way, why that so quickly after the initial California law went into effect, we had to vote again on a new proposition.
Yeah, I voted against it in part because I couldn't easily parse what was happening with it. And
I really feel
that California is already besotted with so many horribly written laws that are really hard to follow and have, you know, unclear impacts on voters, and have really harmful effects down the line. Like, look at Prop 13.
Which is
a real estate law, which you can have an entire different podcast on. But, you know, ultimately, I think that Prop 24 is good in the sense that, even though I voted against it, I think it's good in the sense that it gets people thinking and discussing this.
Yeah.
But it's very early in the process, you know, as Jason noted. And I feel like it seems we all do that pay for privacy is a bad idea. I just think that we're already halfway there in a lot of cases. If you have the resources to understand that there are more private email options available to you, for example.
Yeah, I don't use Gmail.
Options,
I don't use Gmail anymore. I decided then, not to. You know, I use a paid service called Fastmail because I don't trust Google with my mail.
Right. Right.
But it is a luxury. I understand.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
So the issue is you could not use Facebook. That's free. You could use Facebook completely for free, in which case they need to monetize you some way, which they do with advertising. Or if you don't like that, you could say, here, I'll give you a few. The estimate is pretty low. It's like $4 a year or something that they get. Off.
But let's say that sounds off.
it seems like it'd be worth more. But anyway, say it's $5 a month. If you really wanted to use Facebook in a private way, you could pay $5. I like that, having that option. That gives you three options. But you think it should be by default private, Georgia?
Yeah.
But then how do they pay for themselves?
I think that if they get caught misusing, going like every time that they get caught misusing our privacy by their own privacy policy, that I think that there should be like we should have a right to our privacy.
Well, if they don't adhere to their privacy policy, they should absolutely punish.
I don't think it should be a little tiny fine. I'm sorry. These fines are nothing to them. They're nothing. You know, and it takes so very long to be able to go through it. They're absolutely ineffective. I think that if I get caught going into your house, Leo, and stealing your documents and then selling them, I'm going to jail.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to say it. Yeah. You run a company. You're the head of that organization. You should be legally liable for everything that happens within your company. And then I bet everyone's suddenly going to be watching their P's and Q's and being much more careful, because that restriction to their own freedom would be something that they would care about. But if I'm making, you know, say I'm making $100 and you're going to fine me $1, that's like just a cost of operation. Great. I'm going to use this without any worry and fear.
Yeah.
So I think that one is there should be laws about our privacy and what information should be used and what information shouldn't be used. And they should have to disclose what is specifically going to happen in layman's terms that everyone will understand. And that should be across the board. And then they get caught, you know, with Facebook being caught how many times, right?
Yeah, Georgia, I think you're absolutely right. And something like fines being equal to a percentage of rev,
as in GDPR, net,
yeah, mm-hmm. would be great. You know, and the challenge is that even in GDPR, which for the most part is a significant improvement over anything we have in the U.S., there is still a loophole in it that allows companies to remedy the problem and then come back to the regulatory agency and say, look, we fixed it. It's amazing. So even when there are reasonable safeguards ensuring that companies are fined for bad behavior at a rate that is fair, I think it's still really challenging to deal with situations that allow them to do things like fix it when there may not really be a fix. You know, if your data has been stolen and leaked, then, you know, that horse has long since left the barn. There's no way you're going to get that one back.
And often it's
and
not.
I think that laws are not up to laws are just not up to snuff at this point.
Also, I hear a lot of people talking about, oh, well, what is Facebook going to do? How are they going to survive if they can't do this? And I just want to point out, as somebody who worked for a media company for years, poor Facebook, a lot of what they do in terms of personalization, in terms of targeting, you know, some of that is necessary. A lot of it is unnecessary. A lot of personal information gets collected by all of us and we get tracked. And it's all the purpose is to target us and know everything about us. Although what you'll find is a lot of times untargeted advertising works pretty well. Facebook, I get, like, Facebook micro-targets, and it's great for small businesses that need to find a very particular kind of person. But I'm going to say I am, based on my history in the media, extremely skeptical that you cannot put in a privacy regime and limit the information that gets shared and limit tracking that happens, especially across sites, and that tech companies that rely on advertising are not going to be able to find a way to make a living at it. I just don't believe it. I think that they are very smart and that there are lots of ways to sell advertising and there are lots of ways to identify target audiences and that you don't need to do the level of collection. I think a lot of the data collection that goes on is completely unnecessary and is just used as a sales tool. So I think that, the stricter the laws,
that's interesting.
The more evidence you're going to get that a lot of this stuff, not all of it, but a lot of it, and some of the most invasive stuff, I don't think it's really necessary. I think it's just a technique they use to convince people that their ads on the internet are going to be effective. And then, you know, they aren't. Yeah. And we move on with our lives. So I think always make them prove it. Make them prove that they actually need that information, because I don't think they do.
You actually might. You know what, Jason? I think you're right.
I
never even really thought
times
about that, but I think you're right.
In my career in the publishing industry, in print, but also on the web, I cannot tell you how many times we got asked for more data about our customers, more data
agencies
about their
and advertisers
behavior.
Die for that stuff. They demand it.
They don't do anything with it, and it's very rarely used, and it's very rare that it has value. Sometimes it does, but more often it doesn't. It's just a sales technique. Podcasting is going through the same thing now.
We
need to have data about the number of downloads and the time of day, and we need to target. And a lot of it is just a psychological tool that salespeople use to get money right. from their clients. It's not something that anyone at any point in the chain actually uses.
And Facebook has done this before. They did this in 2015 mm-hmm. with video, right? And how many news organizations and publishers died because they listened to Facebook, which told them, you need to move everything to video. Video is the next big thing. Here's how it's going to help your business. All these organizations invested in video and, you know, blammo, they're gone. So
it's the dirty little secret of advertising. Nobody knows what the hell works or why. Is that right?
Right.
Is that fair?
Except yeah. that we do know, right? We do know that there are certain things
it
that
works.
Do work well.
You got to do it.
But we don't need to do the kinds of data mining that
I think
that
agencies
Facebook says we do.
And advertisers right. want to rationalize it.
Well, but you're saying that they're effective in advertising.
Yeah, right? They want to say it's scientific. We're going to get this value.
It's not like there isn't data that is useful. There absolutely is, and Facebook's really good at that. It's that of the ocean of data that gets collected, what of it actually does get used and is effective? And I would guess it's very small, and that they could be limited dramatically by laws in terms of what information gets shared and what cross-site tracking is allowed. And they would still be able to do a pretty good job of targeting, especially advertising, into people's eyeballs. I think that they overstate how much they need. And I I think it's up for them to prove it. I think that as members of the public, we should be demanding as much privacy as we can and hear from those tech giants about what they actually need, because we can't take them at their word.
There is the chat room's reminding me there's a two-part Freakonomics that came out, episode 440 and 441. Does advertising actually work? First one's about TV, which is a $500 billion a year yep. business worldwide. And the second is digital. Google and Facebook are worth $2 trillion themselves. And I don't know what, Jason, do you sell your own podcast or do you have somebody do that for you?
I have my friend Mike Hurley sell on my podcast.
Oh yeah.
That's for me.
Mike's good. And we did a little bit with Mike as well. Right. And of course, Lisa, my wife and CEO of Twit, does a lot of the selling. We have a sales team, but there's a huge demand in podcasting now, and it's almost universal from agencies especially. We've got to know more than just, you know, you're a geek podcast. That's not enough. We got to know a lot more. And I don't want to give them any information. So this is kind of tug of war between.
Yeah, it is.
And Lisa says if we don't do it, we won't get the buy. They'll go to somebody who will. And the problem is Spotify and iHeart, the two biggest podcast companies in the world, are, because they use apps, do know that information and are willing to give it to advertisers. And so advertisers say, well, why would I buy your podcast? I can get all that information from Spotify. If you won't give it to me, see you later. It's very challenging.
Yeah, one of my professors in college actually wrote a book that was essentially, does advertising work? And the answer is yes, sometimes, but not in the ways that you think and not from necessarily the reasons that the advertisers want it to work. It's super complicated. But one thing that you learn spending a couple of decades around salespeople, right, is there's sales technique and what works to make the sale.
Right.
And then there's what is actually required. And I would wager not only that we are living in an era where everybody wants more data, but I would very strongly suggest that the people who want more data won't do anything with it.
Yeah, well, that's been kind of our experience, because sometimes the data is grotesquely wrong and it doesn't matter. It's irrelevant.
For folks that haven't really seen this and want to take a good look at it, I did a piece back in, I think it was October, maybe November, on the Markup's new tool called Blacklight, which shines a light on how you are being tracked across the web, even when you're not logged into sites that are tracking you. And if you get a chance to take a look at that, it's really interesting. There it is. Perfect.
Yeah.
That's a great way to see how these organizations are following you and to what end. It's important these days.
I just, you kind of, a light went on for me with you, Jason, because we all know this is happening. And in my mind, I had justified it, as I just did with you, Georgia, by, well, this is how they pay for these free services. Google and Facebook pay for free services. But if all of this collection of data doesn't actually help them, or make it more efficient, then there is a way out. I mean, we don't have to be doing this.
But even if it didn't, why should we be giving up our privacy and them allowing them to go against their own policies that they placed out, right?
It's a trade. You're using Facebook for free.
But it's not a fair trade. Like, they tell us it's a fair trade, but it isn't really a fair trade because they have the lawyers, they have the legalese, they understand, they've written this privacy policy. No one reads it. I read it every now and then, I'm fine, but I don't understand it when I read it. It's 60 pages long. They try to make this as difficult as possible. Like almost 0% of people will read this. They click, they go, and so they're just
but you use Facebook.
Safety.
Don't use Facebook.
I don't.
No,
okay. I don't use Facebook, well, but let's be honest, is that a company that is going against their own policies should be,
yes.
I don't feel any sympathy for
but
them.
What if they weren't? What if they were doing what they said they were going to do, which is still invasive?
Yeah, I think that there should be laws for what companies should be able to track and how it goes and who they should sell it to. And that we should, like, I think that the entire infrastructure needs to change, whether they're using it for good or ill. I think the entire infrastructure needs to be an overhaul and that it should be, you know, one page and it should be comfortable. If we were going through and going to a contract and we were equal parties, had, you know, the same, you know, lawyers that were going through it, we would make sure that we both fully understand. You go to a court of law, they ask you, do you understand all of the charges that you're going to be waylaid to? I don't think that it's fair that people are going to be held to a contract that they don't understand.
I understand, but I also don't think it's fair that people say, well, I want my Gmail for free and I want my Facebook for free and I'm not willing to do anything to pay for it.
They could change it.
Well,
at
least with Gmail, you have options, right? There's multiple options out there that are, you know, some of them are paid, some of them are free. You could even go use.
But if a service on the web is free,
but there's no other.
You're paying for it somehow.
Option to Facebook.
Yeah, I mean,
there's no other option.
This podcast is free. There's no way I could do what I do if we didn't have advertising. It just wouldn't be viable. I don't think Facebook and Google would be viable if they weren't massive ad companies. I mean, really, that's their real business.
But Leo, I know this is disheartening, but there are other podcasts on the internet that talk about tech besides This Week in Tech
that are free,
that are free.
They don't have ads. Yeah,
that don't have ads.
Well,
and
it's a hobby, not a living for them.
Well, sure, but
I want to make a living doing this. And I do it by advertising. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. You're saying
no.
People should only
honestly,
listen to free
right?
pod.
No, I'm saying that Facebook is a monopoly. There's no other choice.
Oh, I see.
There's no legitimate social
network.
Yeah,
if you don't like ads, you could listen to something else.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Or there's other ways, you know, of doing things. But there really is no other option at this point. And this sort of ties into a story from last week that Reuters ran that, you know, Facebook and Google are about this close to facing legal action from the U.S. government.
It's just about to happen, But wait. Now, if there were a wonderful place that made the best soup in the world down the street, and it really, there was nowhere else that you could get soup with that was that good. That wouldn't justify you going in and saying, I'm not going to pay you for the soup. Give me the soup. It doesn't matter that that's the only place you can get that soup. You got to pay for it. That's the deal. I don't think monopoly or not monopoly makes any difference. If you want that service, you should pay for it.
Yeah, but they don't want us to pay for it for money because they won't make as much.
Well, maybe they do. I mean, they were instrumental behind this Prop 24 when that was one of the big things that people didn't like about Prop 24 is the pay for privacy clause. So,
well, they were kind of squeezed into that. They would rather it be the way that they're doing it now.
Facebook would prefer, but I don't think it's reasonable to say, well, we shouldn't give them anything for the service we get from them.
I think it's fine to give them. They can ask for whatever.
Give them anything because I don't use it, but. It's not, I mean, just because they're monopoly, if it's the only place you can get that soup doesn't mean I can steal it because I can't get anywhere else.
Yeah, well, I don't think anyone's saying steal it.
So we're going back to the whole, you know, to the 90s internet and does information want to be free? This was like the big debate.
And
the
biggest myth of the hacker manifesto was information wants to be free. Maybe you want it that way, but apparently they were wrong on that one. Yeah.
So, and I don't think that the commercial internet has ever really come up with a good way to move beyond that. Some things on the internet are free. Some you have to sign up and you give them your email, you know, Facebook or whatever. Some things you do have to pay for. There are certain email services you can pay for. And I think that if Facebook weren't a monopoly, if there were other options, if Instagram was its own entity, if WhatsApp was its own entity, you know, there would be much more diversity in what you can do.
Oh, that's clear.
And there would be, you know, I'm like, if you're a parent and you don't want your kids' photos plastered all over Facebook, but you do want to share them with a group, is there a social network that you can pay for a nominal fee, you're able to share photos and details and whatever, and not worry about having your toddler data mined? You know, I think those kinds of questions are really interesting. We haven't seen effective answers to them. We've seen a lot of sort of plays and stabs, but nothing has really stuck.
The Hacker Manifesto information wants to be free. I think what we've learned is that the gatekeepers want to keep the gate. Because we thought in those days, no more gatekeepers. You're going to, anybody who wants to put up a blog or a video or whatever, anybody can do anything. There's no more networks. There's no more newspapers. There's no more gatekeepers. And I think what we've learned over time is for whatever reason, the gatekeepers end up keeping the gate. YouTube now is run by Google. And yeah, you get to put videos up for free, but Google still gets to pick who is the winner and who's the loser. I feel like the gatekeepers. How about, Jason, what do you think? I was thinking about this morning. This is my new thesis, that for some reason, we didn't get rid of gatekeepers. We thought we would with the internet, but we didn't get rid of them.
Well, you know, Ben Thompson, who does Stratechery, talks a lot about aggregation theory, right? And you either want to be on one end of the funnel or the other end of the funnel. And you can see it, like having the enormity of YouTube or Facebook, like that is so powerful. And it is very hard to not end up in situations like that unless you have regulation. This is the argument for regulation. And I'm not a big, like, let's regulate everything kind of person, but there is a point at which you have to regulate what happens.
That's just replacing,
or you will just go to a monopoly.
That's just replacing one gatekeeper with another, the government. It's depressing to me because I think we all thought with the internet, there was this great hope that would be the ultimate democratic institution, that everybody would get a voice. And what it ended up happening, Ben calls them aggregators, but really the aggregators are no different really than the old gatekeepers. I mean, the New York Times was, I guess, an aggregator of stories written by its journalists, you know, but it was a gatekeeper. If you couldn't get into that, when I started in radio, if you couldn't convince one of a handful of radio stations to give you a job, you didn't get on the air. Now anybody can have a podcast.
It's not quite a gatekeeper in the sense that I can post things on YouTube and YouTube is happy to let me do that.
Yeah, nobody will see it.
If I had mailed it to the New York Times, they're going to be like, no. I'm not a crackpot. I'm not going to put this on. But they still contain this enormous amount of power, especially in terms of reach, right? Because they, you know, YouTube or Facebook reaches this huge audience and they're sort of the only game in town or one of the only games in town.
Right. So my this wonderful idea that anybody can get into radio and do a podcast is true, but without the gatekeepers, without Apple's iTunes and iHeart and the various directories, no one's going to know you're doing the podcast. You're talking to thin air. It's a little disappointing to me, but I think it's the way the world is. It's interesting how we trend in that direction, no matter what. Anyway, I have to take a break because I got to pay for this. I can't do this for free. All these boughs of holly, they don't come cheap. They don't come cheap. I can't go and say, hey, Holly store, give me holly. Give it to me for free. I want it for free. No, they make me pay for it. So I'm going to make you pay right now. Listen to this ad. And if you don't like it, go listen to some podcast without ads. Good luck to you. You really depress me with that, Seth. You can always listen to somebody else.
I do that.
You just depress the hell out of me.
Every time you have me on, you get really.
You know, there
you
are
really
podcasts without ads. You know that, right?
That's not what I said.
I don't have
a
monopoly.
They don't have us on it. They don't have us on it. So there's
they
still
might.
Yeah.
They might. Yeah. There's no reason why you couldn't be on it. Our show today brought to you by WWT. This is actually a great company. About 10 years ago, they started building what they call the Advanced Technology Center. Lisa and I went out to visit it earlier this year when you could still travel. We went to St. Louis. The ATC is amazing. Started in one little building, one little rack of servers, and now it's mile after mile of racks in many buildings, $500 million in equipment. What they've done, because they're consultants, they're experts, they help big companies buy and use enterprise technology. What they've done is they've just aggregated all of the biggest and best technologies from the hundreds of OEMs and key partners, like heavyweights like Dell Technologies and VMware and Intel. But and also the little guys, the emerging disruptors, companies like Equinix, they put it all in this ATC. Their engineers, it first started up, I think, mostly because their engineers, you know, wanted to work in these labs to beta test new equipment, to build, you know, proofs of concept and reference architectures and to set up integrations for their customers to make decisions and see results faster. But they realized there's so much value in having this ATC that they should open it up to customers as well. And this is what makes WWT such an interesting company. They really are a partner that people stay with over decades. Many of their customers have been with them since the beginning because they know they can go to WWT to get the answers they need to make sure their business runs right in every possible arena. So as an example, they have at the Advanced Technology Center on-demand, schedulable labs you as a customer can use for things like Dell's VxRail or PowerStore, or Unity or PowerMax, Data Protection Central, and IDPA. This is, if you're looking at storage, these labs have the latest, greatest in primary storage. And there's hundreds of labs there covering everything from networking, secondary storage, data analysis, AI. You can learn so much just as your engineers do about the products before you launch them. You can use the ATC lab environment to make sure you're getting the right solution that solves the problem you're trying to solve. And frankly, the ATC reduces concept time from months to weeks. It really improves speed to market. This lab as a service is exactly what makes WWT unique. They could say, oh, no, we built this. We'll keep it to ourselves. No, they let their customers do their own programmatic testing using this vast $500 million technology ecosystem that they've built. And they're always building. They're always adding more. If something new comes along, they add it. And it's completely virtual. You don't have to go to a St. Louis like we did. You can use the ATC anywhere in the world 24/7. They launched this last year, their digital platform encompassing the entire ATC ecosystem. It's a multiplier of knowledge and speed and agility for their customers and their partners anytime, anywhere in the world. You'll not just the labs, you get access to articles, case studies, all the tools you need to make a difference in today's fast-paced world. You want to learn more? Here's what you do. You can actually sign up and start using the labs right now. WWT.com/twit. Learn more about Worldwide Technology, their Advanced Technology Center. Become a member of their growing community. It's a place where people go to get answers, to learn. WWT.com/twit. You can create an account and gain access to their on-demand labs right now. Worldwide Technology simplifies the complex. WWT.com/twit. Worldwide Technology, delivering business and technology outcomes around the world. Well, thank you, WWT, for your support of Twit all year long. And you can support Twit as a listener by going to that site, WWT.com/twit. That was a great conversation. Thank you. Kind of went places I didn't expect it to go. Very interesting. And it just started with talking about Slack. See, you never know. We got a great panel here. Seth Rosenblatt is a security guru from the-parallax.com. Don't forget the dash at Seth R on the Twitter.
Still waiting for someone to buy me that full URL.
Somebody's got it. I know. I want leo.com. Yeah. I can't get it. It's gone. Some squatter stole it, and I can never get it. It was the Bank of Canada for a long time. I guess that was their mascot. And then they let it go.
That's so weird.
Yeah, and I didn't
catch it. That's so weird. They don't even have lions up there.
They did. RBC's mascot was a lion. Leo the Lion. No. I think that was the whole idea. I don't know.
Yeah.
Do you remember that, Georgia? Georgia Dow's in Montreal.
You still have the little emblem.
Yeah, it's on their logo. Yeah, yeah. Anxiety-Videos, where she sells with her partner videos, not just about anxiety, but being a better parent, sleeping better. Georgia and has also been very generous the last few times you've been on during COVID-19. She's a licensed psychotherapist, and she gives out her email. So if you have a, even if you're not in Montreal, you can email georgia@westmounttherapy.com. Are people doing that?
They do. I can't give therapy online unless you're actually a client, but I can help out or help out how to find therapy or what,
that's nice,
you know, makes for good therapy. Or some people are like, no, we'll do different things. And there's lots of options out there.
Jason Snell's also here from The Incomparable. And
yes, indeed. I'm drinking out of my incomparable mug right now.
The greatest podcast network ever. Yeah.
And sixcolors.com, where I had to pay like $4,000 or $5,000 to get it without the dash.
You're kidding. You had to buy that from somebody?
I did. Bastards. I did. It was worth every penny.
You didn't want sixcolors.pizza? Because I bet you could have gotten that.
I probably could have. I learned a long time ago when I had an unspellable domain that was not a .com, that everybody wants something you can spell that's a .com. So yeah. I paid the money and I'm happy for it.
Yeah.
I also do have the colors with a U just for Georgia.
Oh, do you?
Thank you.
Six colors with a U. Sure.
Fancy.
You know, Canada needs to be represented.
Aren't you fancy?
That was a lot cheaper.
We go there. You didn't know this, but it was aptly named because you become famous for the quarterly charts you do on the Apple results. They're so useful.
They're very colorful because I use those colors.
All six.
It's in the name.
All six of them. Every one of them. Every time I check, I count. Also, great podcast there. I imagine people around you and Dan Morin and people around you are very excited about the M1. I've come and gone on this. When Apple announced it, I was over the moon, as people will know, and everybody said, calm down, calm down. And I said, no, you don't understand. This is the greatest thing. And then I got mine, and I calmed down because as fast as it is, it wouldn't run some of the things that I really wanted. Mostly geeky edge stuff like Emacs and stuff.
That's it. Yeah. And Homebrew, where you're building a lot of stuff, it's not there yet for Apple Silicon. I think that's part of the charm of these Macs, though, is that they're still Macs and recognizable. And if most of the stuff you do, they just work. And so even though it's a lot faster, I mean, the speed you can get for that $999 MacBook Air is kind of mind-blowing. It is still just a Mac doing Mac stuff, but it is the most exciting thing to happen, I think, to the Mac in years. So we are loving it. And
I think you could argue it might be the most exciting thing to happen to desktop computing in years. And maybe not so much the M1, although I have to say, I never used Safari for a long time. I was just Firefox. I don't like Chrome. It's a pig. And I use Firefox everywhere, Windows, Mac, and Linux, so it was convenient to sync it up. But I'm only using Safari on the M1 MacBook Pro because, oh my God, I didn't know the web could be that fast. I thought it was about bandwidth. But apparently, after you get the website, there's a certain amount of churning that has to go to generate it. I opened twit.tv because Lisa's been using my old MacBook Air. And I said, oh, Lisa, you're going to want this. She said, no, I'm not. I said, Lisa, look, come here. I'm going to load, for the first time ever, twit.tv on this site. It came up literally the whole thing like that. And it was like mind-boggling. They're definitely doing something pretty amazing.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on. There was a back and forth on Twitter the other week that was a cranky reviewer basically saying Apple has cheated by making JavaScript so fast, which, I mean, it's faster. That's not cheating. It actually
faster.
Is faster. But it's interesting to see when you control your own operating system and you built your own chip, you can prioritize certain kinds of tasks. So, like, I can edit 4K video on that MacBook Air, the $999 MacBook Air, and it is way better at it, way more capable than on a $5,000 iMac Pro from 3 years ago. And why is that? It's because Apple's got a lot of video encode decode stuff that it built in because it knows people edit video on their platforms.
Right.
The net result is great.
That's why having the hardware and the software together works, because you can make a purpose-built chip. Now, I'm going to say, though, so one of the tools that I really love and use, and it's very much an edge case, is it's a programming environment and language called Racket. And they have a IDE called Dr. Racket, and it didn't work. One of the guys, Matthew Flatt, spent some energy. It didn't take him that long. 3 days after he got his M1 Mac, he said, okay, I've made it work. And it compiles and works. And now, I guarantee you that Apple did not optimize for Dr. Racket. It's a scheme-like language. It's like, you know, I mean, I know they didn't optimize. That thing, I can't use my iMac Pro with 64 gigs of RAM and 10 cores anymore because it feels like a pig. So it is faster across the board, even in things Apple didn't contemplate. There's a Lisp that I use, SBCL, Steel Bank Common Lisp, that is, somebody asked one of the maintainers, are you going to do it? Are you going to update it? Because it won't run at all. There is stuff that literally, it won't even run on Rosetta. It just won't run. And he said, no, I don't have an M1 Mac. So I said, look, let me buy you one because I want this. And they put up the fundraiser. He's actually raising, he's raised, I think, enough money now to buy at least a Mac Mini. Eventually he's going to, it's on Reddit. So he put up a fundraiser for it. Thank goodness, because if people spend a little time, it's not it's little tweaks. Some of it's Big Sur security tweaks. It's not even M1.
So if you rely on that app, that's $700 well spent to send that guy a Mac Mini, right?
Absolutely.
So my question for you, Leo, is what does Microsoft, what does Qualcomm, you know, what is the response? Is this enough of a game changer in terms of price, you know, and power and energy usage for the PC side to look at this and say, we have to find a way to be more integrated than we are right now?
Right.
Or is it just not a big deal?
Right now, what I see from PC people for the most part is, tell me when you can run a Radeon GTX 630 or...
Well, sure.
Tell me when Far Cry looks good on it. But they're missing the point. And I don't think it's the pressure's on quite yet. Here's what I see, Jason. I think it's going to be very interesting. This M1 is really, really, really fast. But this is the first one.
Yeah. It's a low-end chip.
What about next year and the year after? What about a Mac Pro that has 64 cores, you know, 32 high efficiency, 32 lower power, and I don't know, 64-core GPU built into the system on a chip with 64 gigs of RAM of unified memory architecture? But when that comes out in a year or two, then what is the PC industry going to say? The pressure will mount. And I suspect, I actually told people on the radio show, this might be jumping the gun. I said, buy a Mac Mini and start learning Mac OS. I know you hate Mac OS. I know you hate Apple. I know you hate it. But trust me, in a year, you'll wish you were using it. Because I don't think Microsoft and Qualcomm can compete.
Yeah, if I'm Microsoft, I do have to start thinking about, like, is there a way for us to How do we be more Apple-like? Because I think they've been playing that game for a while now, and it's really served them pretty well to be like, what are the secrets to Apple having its own hardware with its own software? And we've seen that with the Surface line. But the challenge now is that, you know, that it's Intel or Qualcomm, essentially, making these chips that they can shop for, and it's not integrated, and they're not able to take advantage like Apple has.
Exactly.
And I don't know where it goes from there.
It has to be Microsoft, but Microsoft's never going to do it. Because they have all these other companies that make Windows computers and they can't screw them. So it's the innovator's dilemma kind of. The problem is you can't cannibalize your existing business. Only Apple's business sucked so bad that they could do that. That's not actually fair, but they were small enough and they made enough money on the iPhone that they didn't mind disrupting the Macintosh ecosystem.
And they figured that their users will come with them. They've always figured that, which is why they've done like three or four chip transitions and they did the OS X transition and they just figured that they're going to come along for the ride and they generally do.
They also didn't need Mac to be, it was a small part of their business. It's a little wedge on your graph.
Yeah.
So they can afford to cannibalize Mac a little bit. And I'll be honest, I think that's a $6,000 iMac Pro that I'm not going to use much anymore. I don't think people understand how much this is going to disrupt the Intel Mac world. It's a different game.
I mean, it's almost already over. For people who are looking at this from the other side and saying, you know, how fast are these low-end chips? The only Macs that are running Intel that are faster than it are a couple of i9 configured to order iMacs at the very, very high end, the most expensive iMacs you can buy, and the iMac Pro and Mac Pro with the Xeon processor. That's it. So, like, every other Mac, every other iMac, every other MacBook Pro, they're all slower than a $999 MacBook or a $699 Mac Mini, which, you know, if you extrapolate, what's the next chip going to be like and what else is Apple going to do? But exactly. It's starting from this position. These are the weakest Apple silicon chips that will ever be in Macs, and they're already like just dramatically more powerful.
Yeah, and PC people hate it when we say this because it's just they go, oh no, don't worry, AMD and Intel can do this. I feel like there may be they'll try, but I don't know. I don't know. This is some pretty secret sauce they got Apple's got going on, and it's not like this is the first time they've made an ARM chip. They've been doing this since 2007. They kind of know what they're doing. So I don't think there's pressure yet. The pressure will mount. And over the next year or two, people have no idea. I mean, the potential for this chip is mind-boggling. And as soon as I can get, you know, the things that I need, I found an Emacs, right, a development version of Emacs that runs native. Once you get things running native, the problem is a lot of stuff doesn't even run on a Rosetta. Like some of the weird stuff doesn't even run.
We're just starting to see it all. There are a couple of guys who took QEMU, the open source emulator, and they got Windows on ARM running on it. And it runs like twice as fast as on a Surface X.
Which isn't saying much. The Surface X is awful.
10 or whatever it is. It's not great. But the idea here that this hardware that is running in a virtual machine on Apple Silicon is still able to put it out like that. I think that's a good example where I think it's really Microsoft, right? Windows ARM is not a product, right? It's only bundled with hardware. And now there's another place it could potentially run. And I imagine it will. I mean, I wrote a thing, I think, this week basically saying it's going to happen. It's just a matter of when they're ready. But it's clearly possible for that stuff to happen, so that'll all get there. But it is a chip transition. Like, as boring as it is, there's still going to be some things that don't work, and there's still some reasons to use an Intel Mac if you're on one, because it all works and that platform's been there for 15 years.
Anyway, I know Windows people hate me when I say this, so I'll make up for it. And meanwhile, in Italy, Apple's in big trouble. This will make you feel better. $12 million fine, which is basically the cigarette money in Tim Cook's couch. Man, but
there's a couch, yeah.
Yeah, but I think they're absolutely right. It's for misleading iPhone water resistance claims. And the Italian watchdog cited this famous, I won't play the audio, but the famous ad where they have an iPhone 12 in a test chamber and they do all sorts of miserable things to it, including dumping a ton of water on it. And it turns out that the iPhone, you can only call the iPhone 11 and 12 waterproof if in specific lab conditions with the use of static, pure distilled water. You can't dump a wedding cake on it and make it rain. But furthermore, and I think this was really the big issue, was Apple, their warranty, and I know this because I had it happen to me, they will not warranty water damage.
Yeah.
So they advertise water resistant, but then don't get it wet, because if it breaks, you're in
trouble. Outrageous. It's outrageous that they advertise water and dust resistance, but if you drop your phone in the toilet or in the pool and it dies because the water entered and broke something, they won't cover it. So, you know, what they basically say, I've asked them about this time and again, and what they say is, we're making it less likely that when you drop it in the water that you'll need to replace it. But if you drop it and you need to replace it, you got to pay. And I think I don't like that, but I really hate it when they then roll out an ad campaign like they did last year for the iPhone 11 series, where they're showing it be impervious to all these things. Because the implication there, I would say, is that it's safe for you to drop it in the water, and that if it fails, that's Apple's failure. And Apple's saying, no, if it fails, it's your problem. And it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And everyone's probably dropped their phone in the toilet, in the sink, in the pool. Like, it just happens, right? So they can't say that it's, you know.
Georgia, your former colleague and mine, Serenity Caldwell, I mean, she lost a phone in a swimming pool taking some video underwater. And it's not unreasonable at all to think, if this is a waterproof phone and I want to take video underwater, I can do that.
Yeah.
And
if you try it and it fails, don't do it.
I've done the same thing. Like, we used to do it just for tests, for fun. But even Renee, he has a whole bunch of, like, you know, underwater shots that he took with the phone. And I, you know, after that, I'm like blowing all, like trying to get water out. And I'm like hoping that this is not going to be the phone that, you know, this one's the time that it dies. But it happens so often. So, yeah.
Good sound in our chat room says you didn't. You missed the disclaimer at the bottom of the video that says professional iPhone user on a closed pool. Do not attempt.
Yeah. Professionals only.
Yeah.
Distilled water only. Distilled water only, please.
Please. Anyway, so 12 million, no big deal. And I'm sure Apple just says fine, fine, whatever. But I hope that that raises some awareness in the fruit company a little bit.
I mean, I will say, having tested these things, they have done a lot lately in the last like 5 years of making the iPhone more water resistant and dust resistant and shatterproof. It still will break. But I think as an iPhone user, it's really nice to know that if I drop it, because I've done that, drop it in water, there's a good chance it'll be fine. And 5 years ago, that was not true. So that part of it is good. It's just making this is a claim that I think is misleading, that if it breaks, it's Apple's fault, because they'll still blame you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see. So there. See, I gave you a bad Apple story. Make you feel better about the M1. Apple has announced their best of 2020. We're going to do a whole show on it on iOS today, on Tuesday. The best products in the App Store. I don't know what they are. Fantastical, yes, I agree. Endel, which is a really cool relaxation and sleep app.
I have not used that.
It's
cool. Is it just like 4D sound that you're listening to?
Yeah, but what's cool, it was the Apple Watch app of the year, because they have an Apple Watch version for it, which is kind of neat. Let's see. Genshin Impact. Don't know it. Also Play Store best game winner for iPhone Game of the Year. Legends of Runeterra, iPad Game of the Year. Disco Elysium, Mac Game of the Year. Dandara Trials of Fear, Apple TV Game of the Year. And for Apple Arcade, Sneaky Sasquatch, which is kind of fun. Okay, I guess
that's cute.
Enough.
Cute game.
Yeah. You're a Sasquatch and you have to sneak around. All right. Just thought I'd mention it. No big deal. I don't understand, since we're in the Apple section, I don't understand this acquisition and why they're making a big deal about it. Former venture capitalist at Greylock Partners, he led early investments in Discord and Musical.ly, hired away from Greylock, Josh Ellman, to run the App Store. Jason, you probably know why this is a big deal. Why would Apple hire this VC to run the App Store?
I don't understand why. It's to work on the App Store, right? Whatever that means. And help customers, he says, discover the best apps for them.
Boy, they must be giving him a ton of money. I mean, if the guy's a VC at Greylock,
And what is his skill set? I mean,
he was vice president of product at Robinhood. So that was a wildly successful stock trading app.
I mean, the best pitch I could do, because I really am a little bit boggled by this, is probably that Apple views App Store revenue as important because it's part of their services revenue, and that they view enhancing App Store revenue by selling more apps as being super valuable. And this guy is going to help figure out how to get more apps in front of people and sell more apps and generate more App Store revenue. And that's sort of his thing. But it's a weird one, unless there's some behind the scenes, like secret power of his that we're not aware of. But also to leave VC and go work for Apple is an interesting choice for him too. That's gotta be a real change in pace and attitude.
People must really want to work for Apple. I can't believe Lori Gill left MacBreak Weekly to work at Apple. I mean, that's just nuts. Serenity Caldwell left iMore to work for Apple. What is wrong with people? Thank God you're not working for Apple, Jason.
Yeah, it's I'll tell you this: Apple is in a more stable industry than the media.
Yeah,
so,
you're probably right. Yeah,
but
it's nice
capital,
to work for yourself, capital. Jason.
It is very much nice to work for yourself.
They're waving the temptation wand over Jason as we speak. We asked Renee Ritchie. So when are you going to Apple? He wouldn't talk. He wouldn't say anything. They've stolen so many of our hosts at this point. Stolen's not the right word. Enticed.
Enticed. Well, you work in the media long enough, and it's nice to work for a company that is hiring and not, doing rounds and rounds of layoffs. So I get it.
Yeah.
But again, venture capital guy playing with money all day.
Yeah.
Rolling around. And that's what they do, right? Yeah. That's what VCs do, is roll around in money all day. Yeah. And now he's going to have to, like, work for a company. So that'll be different.
Yeah.
We'll see how long that lasts.
Apple did do, and I want to give them kudos. They reduced the commission for anybody except Epic and Spotify to practically. That's practically the.
That's pretty much what they did. They're like, you know what? You're going to take us to court. Guess what we're going
to
do?
From 30% to 15%. If you make more than $1 million, you got to pay the 30%. Now, the International Book Publishing Association, or I'm sorry, Independent Book Publishing Association says, hey, what about books? You still charge 30% for Apple Books. Let's lower the price there, too. Is Apple doing this because they're really nice and they feel like they've overcharged people all this time? Or are they doing it more because they're looking at the antitrust action going on all around them? And the amount of time Tim Cook's spending on the Hill and going, we better do something.
Such a small amount. It's not going to really affect them, right? These are for people that are made the last year $1 million or less, right? So it's not going to be a huge dent for Apple to be able to do that. It causes a whole bunch of goodwill, whole bunch of, you know, we've dealt with it, and it does, you know, put a little bit of a pin into Epic. Yeah. I'm sure that made them good too.
I love it. They should have just said, unless you're Spotify or Epic, they should have just said that. That would have been really funny.
Yeah, I mean, it's a vast majority of their developers and a teeny tiny fraction of the money that passes through the App Store. So it's a great PR move. And you could see in the anger of those guys like David Heinemeier Hansson and Sweeney, right? You could see they were kind of rageful when this announcement happened.
They knew who
it was. It's because it was a good chess move. It was a good chess move.
You're so right, Jason. You're so right.
Good chess move.
Because they were, especially when Tim was coming out, like, I'm doing this for the little guy. I'm fighting for those companies. And that's what we're into it. And then they said, oh, guess what?
Good idea.
We'll take care of the little guys. Yeah. We just won't take care of you.
So that's a very good point, too. It didn't cost them that much because the bulk of the revenue from the App Store, you think, comes from people over $1 million. That's really where the big bucks is for them.
Yeah, it's the big whales who are doing like lots of in-app purchase and stuff like that. That's where the bulk of the money comes from. So it is one of these things that has a big impact in terms of like a happy story about a small business without it really cutting into Apple's bottom line very much.
Yeah. Let me think. I think that we've done Apple. We're done on Apple. And there is rejoicing heard around the world. We will move on. That was our Apple segment. Okay.
Can I posit a question?
Yes.
I'm listening to this and I'm not an Apple device user these days.
Care. You don't.
And no, actually, I care greatly. I'm not sure where Apple came up with its 30% number in the first place. And even 15% sounds to me to be very, very high for what they are
doing, which is a fairly 30 is not bad at all. Thing. I mean, if you were selling in the old days, if you were selling your software through Ingram or any of the big distributors, they take 50%. Microsoft and Sony both take 30% for game titles sold in their platforms. 30 is kind of the going rate, I think.
Are they doing that because Apple started taking a 30% take from the iTunes Store first?
I think it's the standard.
In 2008 as well, which was, you know, a very different period than it is now. Leo said, 30% was a number that maybe they pulled out of a hat, but you look around at other closed platforms and it didn't seem unreasonable.
Right.
And in the moment,
it seemed great.
It actually seemed generous because, in fact, Steve Jobs at one point said, or you can sell it for free and we won't charge you anything. And we'll host the download and you don't have to pay anything. It's completely free if you want your app to be free. And at the time, that was like, wow, that's really generous of them. So it's just only over time. And they make some disingenuous arguments, right? Because it's not like you couldn't buy software online in 2008. Right. You could. And for a lot, using Kagi or something like that. And you would share a lot less of the money with your processor than 30%. But it was still, you know, not unreasonable for the time looking at it as a closed platform. It's just that in 2020, it looks a little bit less generous.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And unlike Kagi, they did all the hosting. They did the promotion.
Yeah.
You were getting a lot more than just, we'll help you with a financial transaction. I mean, being on the iPhone has been, I think, very lucrative for a lot of people. But
those small developers will tell you that the 15% they're now going to
take is really good.
Worth giving to Apple, given what they get in return.
Yeah, I think that's fair at this point. I think that's very fair. And if you're making $1 million a year, the funny thing is, if you're making $1 million a year, it's a lot of money you're giving Apple. That 15% is a significant
difference. That might
make
people say, you know what, we're going to pull the app now.
Yeah.
Right? We're at 990. We're going to be like, let's pull the app for a little while. Let's not make any more so that we don't get bumped up the next year to 30.
Yeah, no kidding. All right, let's take another break, and then we will come back. And I've been putting this off because it's going to be a little bit painful. We could talk about the labor issues at Google. For years working in broadcast media, I was told there's two subjects nobody cares about, court and labor. We're going to do both. We'll save the stuff. I saved the stuff nobody cares about. That's coming up. It's great to have you guys, though. Georgia Dow, wonderful to see you. Jason Snell, it's been way too long. Seth Rosenblatt, always a pleasure. For some reason, I assumed that you lived in Brooklyn, that you weren't a California voter. But now I remember you're in Silicon Valley, aren't you?
I'm in San Francisco.
Yeah, you deserve being in Brooklyn. You should have been in Brooklyn. Is that
hell
right?
Hell no, it's too damn cold.
Yeah. Who's the beeping coming from? It's not from me, is it? It's Seth. Something of yours is beeping.
Beeping?
I'll let you check it while
I'm not hearing it, but I'll... Yeah, you do your thing and I'll take a look.
Yeah, we hear a beeping coming from me. This episode of This Week in Tech brought to you... There it is. You hear that?
Yeah.
Yeah. What's that? What is that? It's me? They're saying it's me. Oh, yeah. Every time they say Leo 2, for some reason, is it me beeping? Every time. It's not Seth. Seth, it's not you. It's coming from inside the house. Every time they say Leo 2, it beeps. I don't know why.
Why?
Because I'm not Leo 2, am I? Yeah.
From inside the Leo.
Now the chat room has just gone crazy saying Leo 2, Leo 2, Leo 2. Here, let me turn my sound up again. We'll see. Let's see. That's me. Say Leo 2. Oh, see?
Oh, my goodness.
Who's Leo 2 when he's at home? Our show today brought to you by Barracuda. Barracuda. Bling. Barracuda is the provider of client. I try to resist doing that every time, but I can't. It's, as of course, everybody knows the name Barracuda, cloud-enabled enterprise-grade security solutions that protect everything you've got from email to networks to data to applications. Let's talk about your email today. Barracuda's total email protection. 91% of all cyber attacks start in email. That is the number one vector for getting spearfished and getting account takeover and conversation hijacking and ransomware. We see the stories again and again. Steve Gibson talks about it all the time. You got to know what's in your email, and that's what Barracuda is so good at. And remember, you've got now employees working at home where they don't, you know, they can't say, hey, does this look right, this email? Did you just send me an email, boss? They don't have the software protection. Well, they don't if they don't have Barracuda total email protection. The Barracuda researchers since January have noticed a spike of 667% in coronavirus-related spear phishing. The spear phishers pose as the World Health Organization. They promise information. They give you a download or a PDF, and of course, it's not that. It's ransomware. Get the protection you need for your company with Barracuda's total email protection. It's an all-in-one email security, backup, and archiving tool. Gives you AI-based protection from spear phishing, account takeover, and business email compromise. You need that because, the bad guys are not sitting still. They're constantly refining their attacks. You need protection that is constantly evolving to take care of that. You also get an automated incident response that helps you quickly and efficiently address attacks. We know the faster you respond to a malware attack, the less damage it does. They'll even give you security awareness training for your employees, because they are, after all, the first line of defense against attack. Now, here's the key. You can get a free email threat scan right now of your Office 365 account, and no risk, no pressure. All you have to do is go to barracuda.com/twit. I know there's some bosses who say, I don't want to know. I just don't want to know. But really, you got to know. I know it's frustrating. It's scary. It's bad out there, but you got to know. Barracuda.com/twit. Uncover the threats hiding in your inbox. And then after you get that secure free scan, I think you really ought to consider Barracuda Total Email Protection. Barracuda is your journey secured. Protect yourself with Barracuda. So I apologize for the beeping. I furthermore apologize, Seth, for accusing you of the beeping. I'd never heard that sound before.
And then, I'm just offended that you accused me of living in Brooklyn.
All right. Tell me I'm wrong. Doesn't he look like he belongs in Brooklyn? You look like Seth.
There Rogen. Were crickets there, man. There no, were crickets.
They're too polite. They're too polite. People at home were thinking, yeah, Brooklyn, for sure. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So I don't know. There is labor strife aplenty at Google. The NLRB is now accusing Google of surveilling its employees and other labor violations. They investigated the firing of several employees in November, a year ago, not this past November. And they say that Google violated parts of the National Labor Relations Act by surveilling employees and generally interfering with, restraining, and coercing employees in the exercise of their rights guaranteed by the National Labor Relations Act. You have the right, by the way. Okay, if you're my employees, stop listening for a second. You have the right to form, join, or assist a union or engage in other protected concerted activities. Don't you dare. No, I don't care. The complaint makes it clear workers have the right to speak to issues of not merely unionizing, but ethical business. And that's a big deal. On the heels of that, Google fired perhaps the best known black expert on ethics and AI, Timit Gebru. She was fired after she complained that her research had been suppressed by Google. Now more than 1,500 researchers and 1,200 Google employees have signed a petition protesting her firing. This is always a challenge for me to weigh into these. The story from Google is she said, I will resign if you continue to suppress this or not, at least not tell me why you're suppressing this research. And then Google said, and so she resigned. She says, no, I didn't resign. I was fired. The dispute arose last month when a senior manager at Google told her that she would either have to retract or remove her name from a paper she had co-authored by researchers inside and outside Google, saying, and this is the reason, by the way, Google hired her in the first place, saying that technology companies could do more to ensure AI systems do not exacerbate historic gender biases. She says, I feel like we were censored, and I thought this had implications for all ethical AI research. You're not going to have she was talking to Wired. You're not going to have papers that make the company happy all the time and don't point out problems. That's antithetical to what it means to be that kind of researcher. That's why, you know, she was brought in to help Google with ethics. She's the technical co-lead of Google's ethical AI team. So Google in a lot of labor issues right now.
So just, Leo, just to be clear, legally, if you say you're going to resign at some point in the future and then you're thinking about quitting or something like that and they terminate you immediately, you got fired. Legally, yeah. They fired her. Yeah. And although her boss's boss can say, oh, no, we accept her resignation, it's not true.
That they wasn't a resignation.
Yeah.
It's not a resignation. She was saying it was also like if this is true that you're going to do this, we're going to need to plan for me to leave because this is an unacceptable choice that you made. And they're like, well, you're fired. And then they can claim that it's a resignation, but it's not. Also, their defense of what they didn't like about the paper is amazing because it's basically like it didn't have enough sources. It had like 100 sources, but it seems very clear that what Google didn't like about it is they wanted to insert some things that maybe softened it or made it seem a little bit easier. They basically want to use some PR spin on an academic paper, which is not, I think it really makes everybody should stop and say, why are big companies like this hiring people to do research like this? Because clearly they don't want independent research and independent thought. They want something that'll back up whatever their corporate desire is. That's the message that this firing sends, I think.
Yeah, and that's the more serious issue because, you know, it means she was a figurehead. They hired her to make it look like they cared. But the minute she did anything that challenged the status quo, it was like, see ya, we don't really care.
And they call out a bunch of the processes that Google has for submitting papers and said, well, you know, by the letter of the law. And then what we've heard in the last few days is they never followed that. There were all sorts of things that were submitted at the last minute. People didn't get fired over it. People weren't told to stand down. So in the cases where they can say that she violated some of their rules, they were rules that were never enforced before.
One of the things Google didn't like was in the paper they talked about these large AI models consume a huge amount of processing power and hence a lot of electricity. Google is very sensitive about this energy usage. You know, they've gone 100% carbon neutral, et cetera, et cetera. They said, well, that's old information. The carbon emissions it hasn't been a problem. But you know what? That's not how you don't suppress the research to prove that point. I think this is, I always hate to weigh in on employment issues because there's usually a number of things we don't know, information we don't know about the whole process, but this does not look good for Google at all. The so-called do not be evil company is looking more and more evil.
They got rid of that for a reason, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
When they got rid of that, you went, oh no, wait. Why isn't that your tagline anymore, right? But it also shows that it's such a hard thing to actually stand up to a certain amount of values when you work for these companies. Because I think like she's one person that stood up and said, you know what, I'm going to stand by my research.
Right.
How difficult it is to be able to do that against these large, like any company, to be able to stand up against the people that hired you for a reason. And yes, you're absolutely right. It was so that they could look like they were doing the right thing, and then they could hopefully squeeze it out to make it look like they're not doing as bad of a job as this paper showed that they were. And they didn't like that. And I think that out of 100 people, I think that there would only be a handful of researchers that would be able to stand up. It takes so much fortitude, and it goes to stand where these companies cannot police themselves. For this reason, this is one of the things that shows that these companies do a very poor job. In the end, the company's job is to take care of themselves, not to take care of you. HR is for the company. HR is not for the workers. They just look like they're for the workers.
Yeah.
And you know, I think it's important to also mention that it's not just that other employees were allowed to get away with rule bending and so on, according, you know, to Google's own explanation of what happened, but that the one time that they come down on somebody happens to be an African-American woman who is already in, you know, an extreme minority at the company. This is such a horrific bad look for Google, at the very least. I can't imagine that there's a single labor attorney in California that is not rubbing their hands, hoping that they get this case.
Yeah,
She's got a really good case, and Google is, you know, on the ropes with it, and it's they're not going to come out of this smelling well, no matter what happens.
And this is a PR own goal, right? Like, honestly, you've got an ethics researcher, you fire her in this way, it's public, her message was public, the people know she had outside collaborators who were going to have the paper, we're going to know everything about it. That's what I don't get about it. Like, Leo's right. We never know about behind the scenes things. Maybe there's something where people at Google weren't happy with her work and they wanted her out anyway. Why would you do it this way, in this public way that makes you seem like a villain? I don't understand why they did it the way they did it. Even if they decided that they hated the paper and that they really wish it had been better, I think the right thing to do as a as a crisis advisor would be, you just got a letter published because you hired independent researchers.
It's the Streisand effect, right? Yeah. Jason, now everyone wants to read this paper and what's happening. If they wanted to signal boost what she was coming out to talk about, this was the way to do it.
Yeah.
And you could argue that however damaging this paper was, if Google was seen having had their people involved in it, it would almost be like a credit to Google. Like, look at what Google is allowing. They're allowing criticism of aspects of Google because they've got this group that does independent ethics research. Instead, it sends the opposite message, which is don't believe anything that comes from people who work at Google because the only stuff that they let out is good PR.
Yeah.
Right. And one of the worst things is that of all the various fields that are connected to tech that do need independent review, that do need a real close encounter with an ethics committee, machine learning and algorithms, I think, have to be up at the top. There are other places that do this, but if it doesn't happen in the companies and the companies are not subject to outside scrutiny, it almost isn't going to have much of an effect, right? We need to know as users what's going into these algorithms that are deciding what we see on Facebook, what shows up in Google search, how Amazon is determining what products to show us. I think these are all really crucial questions, and for Google to do this at this time is just so boneheaded. It's a bad look, at the least.
The MIT Technology Review, Karen Howe, has a story. They got the paper. They summarized it. But I think if you ask why should I care, it's an employment issue. The reason you should care comes in the last paragraph of the story. It's a quote from Emily Bender, who was one of the co-authors of Gebru's paper. Bender worries, they say, that Google's actions could create a chilling effect on future AI ethics research. Many of the top experts in AI ethics work at large tech companies because that's where the money is. Bender says this has been beneficial in many ways, but we end up with an ecosystem that maybe has incentives that are not the very best ones for the progress of science for the world. You know, I think everybody understands that AI is a cash cow for a lot of these companies. It's important for research. It's important for us as a country, but that there are potential ethical landmines here. And it's really important that ethics researchers are able to weigh in on this and say things like, for instance, one of Gebru's previous studies was the one that found that women of color were something like 40% misrecognized by face recognition technologies because they've been trained on white men. And so she was the one who first rang the alarm on this. That stuff is important. Otherwise, these AI tools get used. They have built-in biases, and they can really screw things up. And so it's absolutely paramount, if Google's going to be doing AI research, or any company, that they have independent ethics people there who have the power to say, no, this is bad, this is wrong, without fear of censorship. It really is risky. It's really risky.
I wonder if, and this is a very dark turn, so I apologize, but I wonder if this is kind of like the Palladium tea, like that they're fine with it's they are there to send a chilling effect that, you know what, be careful what you choose to stand up against us because we'll fire you and we really don't care.
And that's probably the case.
Trace it back to
yes.
us. That
there's definitely, intentional or not, that's the signal they're sending, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, and the truth is there's a lot of outside independent research that's funded, you know, that comes from places that are funded by corporate money, and they're not necessarily independent either. The tragedy here is the advantage of having somebody, a group like this inside Google, is they get access to Google and Google's tech. And it is important for us all to have somebody who's looking at what Google is doing and not from the outside. At this point, it's hard to see without a pretty dramatic turn on Google's part that anybody is going to really look at the output of that group without a huge amount of skepticism. And I feel bad for the other people who work in that group because I would imagine they're all going to feel like they have to go somewhere else in order to reclaim their credibility. So it's a real, like I said, it's an own goal by Google. Like they, even if they were unhappy with her or some of the work she was doing, I you would think that they would move sort of silently in the background to sort of just wind it up and finish the program or have her go to the door. And instead they just did
I'm
this
glad
out
they
in public.
Didn't. I'm glad they
I am
didn't.
Too. Yeah. We because all benefit it, from knowing the truth.
Yeah. It focuses our minds. You know, companies that are doing AI research have a high, I think they have a high ethical requirement to pay attention to what the impacts of this research are. And if they don't, but, they need to be regulated. Then it's something, you know, yeah. This is where government yeah. needs to step in and say, no.
There is a solution here, I think. And I cannot foresee any future on any, you know, version of Earth in the multiverse that it would fly. But the real solution, I think, is that these companies, especially when they're publicly traded, need to have a corporate ethics ombudsman.
That's right.
And that person cannot be a figurehead, and they have to have some kind of power within the company. That's really the only way I could see, you know, Google coming out of this looking better. And I can't see that happening. But
or we
I would
could
love
have
to
unions.
See it.
Unions would also work.
Unions would help. I absolutely think that tech employees who, you know, are developers and whatnot are long overdue to unionize. But I think people look at their salaries. I think people look at their own salaries and say, what do we need a union for? That would hamper our earning ability if it's tied to metrics. And they look at the way that unions have gone in the U.S. over the past 30 years and say, what do we need any of that drama for either? But I agree. I think unions would be a good place to start.
There's a long history of these companies kind of playing lip service to corporate ethics and doing the right thing. And yeah. It's all just a veneer. Facebook's or oversight board is a perfect example of this. They are now starting to hear cases, but we're learning that the cases they hear, they won't be ruled on for 90 days. Like, oh yeah, 90 days later, oh, we were wrong to take that content down. I'm sorry. Do you want us to put it back up? No one cares about it. It's over. Thank you. So there's all sorts of issues. The idea of the oversight board, the people they picked were very impressive. And the idea was that you could appeal to them about Facebook takedowns or maybe that something that should be taken down is not taken down. But the problem is the board can only take up appeals against removal of content. It's only about removal. It can't look at where cases were disputed materials left up. It can't review cases that aren't appealed. And it's got to operate completely in secrecy. Members of the board can't discuss their work except through Facebook PR. Just overall, and they have 90 days to reach conclusions. They've selected, out of 20,000 appeals, they've selected their first six. So this is a perfect example of Facebook doing something that looks good on paper, is great PR, and is completely pointless. You know?
It reminds me of when you used to be able to vote on changes to Facebook policy. And I remember there was some big one that they did. It was like 2010 or maybe 2011, and almost 300,000 people voted for it in the U.S. But because 300,000 U.S. voters is equal, even back then was equal to, you know, some, you know, tiny percentage of Facebook users, and they decided that it was for global, it had to be a global percentage
count.
Of global users.
Do
it didn't
over.
Count. Yeah. And so it didn't go anywhere,
do
of
over.
Course.
So here's the, here's the six questions that they're going to look at. Should a set of Instagram posts that showed nipples be allowed, considering the photos were part of a breast cancer prevention program? They really picked like tough things to decide. Should historical quotes from Nazi propagandist Joseph Goebbels be allowed to circulate, even if they're in violation of Facebook's dangerous individuals policy? Should screenshots of tweets not even Facebook posts, but tweets by Malaysian Prime Minister stay up in order to raise awareness of the hateful nature of his bigotry or be removed because they violate the hate speech policy. Should posts criticizing the French government be reinstated despite their allusions to alternative treatments for COVID? There's nothing about conservative politicians being censored, nothing about QAnon, nothing about anti-vaxxers. Some of the most thorny problems facing Facebook completely ignored. So, you know, it's just PR. We knew it, but now we know it. You know what I mean? We know it, man. Facebook says we will remove misinformation about COVID vaccines. You know, as we get closer to actual working vaccines, they're going to start to be distributed at the end of this month in the United States to healthcare workers. And it is expected that most of the nation will have access to either the Moderna or what is it? The Pfizer is the second one vaccine by April. What's going to be really important is a public relations and marketing campaign to get people to take these vaccines. What's going to be really important is to get stuff saying don't get vaccinated off Facebook. Right? Or maybe I'm biased in this matter.
No, that's
well,
the next
it makes
frontier
a huge
of
difference,
this.
Right?
That's where it's going to really be where the rubber is going to hit the road, as they say. Yep.
Yeah.
Already,
if not everyone gets it, then it doesn't really. It's still going right. to. We're still going to have an influx of people in our hospitals.
Public
and
health
going to fog up the whole system.
Officials estimate that to get herd immunity, 70 to 80% of the population will have to take the vaccine. A far lower percentage of people say they will. I can't remember what the number was, but it was a very low number, like 50 or 60%.
I mean, this is one of the big concerning things, you know, about the firing of Chris Krebs, who is the leader of CISA, the cybersecurity division at DHS. Is that not only was he working on, securing the election and providing factual information in a digestible way to counter, election disinformation, he was also working on a very similar project for COVID vaccines. And not having a figurehead running that as we, start getting into, a place where we have vaccines that can fight COVID, I think is really it's utterly messed up. I mean, Biden, of course, will put somebody in there. But even though Krebs is a lifelong Republican, he was doing the right thing regardless of politics. And it's certainly going to set the agency back in their efforts to fight vaccine misinformation and disinformation.
He was on Face the Nation this morning and with some very scary information. He says Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea are trying to steal coronavirus vaccine IP. The big four, Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea, we've seen to some extent all four of these countries doing some kind of espionage or spying, trying to get intellectual property related to the vaccine. And what we had been thinking through at CISA was not just the vaccine developers, but the entire supply chain trying to undermine, not merely steal the idea or the recipe, but actually trying to undermine the program. And I expect there will be big disinformation campaigns as well from these countries. This is going to be a big issue. And man, it's really sad that Krebs is no longer running CISA, because this is as important as anything he was doing. It's going to be a big problem.
Yeah.
So, but of course, that's the world we live in right now. What's interesting is despite all of the pressures against him, he was able to make the election run well. This is your bailiwick. Seth, is it considered, he said it was the most secure election we've ever had. Even in 2016, there wasn't really any assertion that the Russians tried to change vote counts. It was mostly disinformation campaigns and things like that, right?
There were assertions that the Russians had changed vote counts. Those proved I'm trying to remember. I think there was maybe one instance in a Florida county where they were able to get access to, I think it was the county registrar.
That's right. They tried to get the voter rolls, but they weren't able to change the actual numbers.
Right. Yeah.
No numbers were actually changed. It's a very heterogeneous system. And we talked to election experts before 2016, including Ron Rivest. There's been a strong consensus since that time that a paper trail fixes the problem. In the 4 years intervening between 2016 and 2020, that was and thanks to Chris Krebs, among others, very successful notion that we put in more secure systems. Yes?
Well, we did. We sort of did it in a haphazard.
Well, that's the election system in the U.S.
Shoestring. No. It had nothing to do with the election system. But if there's any, if you're a Mandalorian fan and you remember the episode where the Mon Calamari guy fixed the Mandalorian's ship Razor Crest with a whole bunch of string and twine, that's sort of what happened. There was a whole bunch of string and twine that led to an improvement in the number of states that created a paper trail, but it wasn't from a federal government mandate, which is really unfortunate. And it means that there are still states and large jurisdictions in some states that do not produce paper trails. It's better than it was in 2016, but it's better than it was by luck. By just people fighting and getting, small victories in their own jurisdictions. Ironically, the defeat of Stacey Abrams in Georgia in 2018 led to Georgia, and it led to a lawsuit. And the consequences of that lawsuit were to mandate that Georgia has to have a risk-limiting audit. So in addition to an improved paper trail in Georgia, they also had to, do the recounts. And that's what led to, that's what's led to this runoff. There's been, a lot of improvements made, but they're not systemic. And there's still plenty of opportunity for backsliding. These are things that I think are tenuous right now. But yes, 2020 was no doubt a much safer election than 2016 in terms of cybersecurity, in terms of reacting to widespread disinformation campaigns. And it's not that the campaigns didn't happen. The campaigns were absolutely out there, but there was just more of an effort to get factual information out there. A lot more jurisdictions were on board with it, as well as national agencies like DHS, CISA.
And it did feel like companies like Twitter and Facebook were kind of throwing off the bots and getting rid of a lot of the disinformation factories and things like that, right?
I have no evidence of this, but my reaction to things and seeing how things have gone on Twitter is that Twitter's decision earlier this year to tamp down on the most egregious misleading tweets from politicians actually had a pretty substantial effect on people who are connected to Twitter, which is, not everybody by any means.
It's not everybody.
Yeah. But those people, I think, are influencers in their own circles. And so when they're not on Twitter, they're probably talking things up. And I think just news reports about somebody taking some kind of action against leadership-driven disinformation is, probably helped out a lot more than we think.
Let's take a little break. Seth Rosenblatt is here. It's great to have you from the-parallax.com.
Thank you.
He's editor-in-chief at SR. Jason Snell, sixcolors.com. Georgia Dow, anxiety-videos.com. Is this your VR room or is this just an office? What is this room?
This is my office. So this is where I podcast and do sessions.
It's great. I love it. It's got a very lavender kind of calming color. We had a fun week this week on Twitter. I thought we'd prepare. Do we have a promo? Yeah, we prepare a little video for you. So you, in case you missed anything, this is what you missed.
Ben Rhodes today, major points. He had Christmas decorations on the bookshelf behind.
This is going to
be a new competition.
Uh-oh. Yeah. Look at this.
Wow. Happy?
Decorations happy complete.
Theo just decked the halls.
Previously on Twit. Tech News Weekly.
The late breaking news that's really interesting. HBO Max is going to get all of Warner Media's 2021 movie catalog the day that they hit the theater. That's a pretty big deal.
This Week in Enterprise Tech.
We're going to talk about the fascinating research around developing eye tracking and just how it can help your organization make some critical business decisions.
This is a set of eye tracking glasses. This is Tobii Pro Glasses 2, and the glasses record their visual attention during that process.
Wow.
Hands on Android.
Google announced that its free Google Photos cloud storage is going away, but I'm going to show you how to create your own cloud storage for your photos next.
Hands on Tech.
Got something brand new, an Apple MacBook Pro 13-inch, but it's not how it looks outside that matters. It's what's inside that counts.
Twit, working at home with you.
If you're working, most of the time you're just eating marshmallows and pretending to work. That's at least me anyway. Our show today brought to you by Casper. I want to talk about that HBO thing in just a second, the Warner Media thing. Very interesting. But first, a word from Casper, my mattress. Man, did I sleep good last night. I have to say, a lot of it is having the perfect sleep environment. And it's the mattress, it's the pillows, it's the sheets, it's the cool glow light. It transforms the way you sleep. That's Casper's mission, to transform the way you sleep. One snooze at a time. Outrageously comfortable products at not so outrageous prices. Here I am opening my new Casper mattress. We've actually had several of them from the original Casper. This is the latest Casper that adds actually some springs in it. It's amazing what Casper's done. They've created a system that reacts and adapts to your body all night long. Inside 1,501 perforations to create a cooling system so effective you won't even notice it because you'll be fast asleep. But sleeping cool really is important to a good night's sleep. Only Casper mattresses are made with 86 supportive gel pods. That's what aligns your spine, eliminates aches and pains. It's both firm and giving. Like a good parent. Altogether, it's the cooling, supportive comfort you need. Even Samantha, our kitty, loves the Casper. With over 20,000 reviews and an average of 4.8 stars across Casper, Amazon, and Google, Casper is rapidly becoming the internet's favorite mattress. I'll say it's mine. I'll say that. And there is no risk, by the way. You could be sure of your purchase with Casper's 100-night risk-free sleep-on-it trial. Free shipping and painless returns in the U.S. and Canada. Get the mattress at a great price that you want. And then if for any reason it's not exactly right, they'll come and get it. You don't have to put it back in that surprisingly compact box. Thank goodness. I don't know how they do that. They'll come and get it, refund you every penny. And now with 0% APR financing options, it's even easier to try a Casper mattress. Wouldn't it be nice to get a good night's sleep on Christmas Eve and wake up and Santa's delivered maybe a Casper pillow or the glow lamp too. Go to casper.com/twit1. Use our offer code TWIT and the number 1, TWIT1. You'll get $100 off select mattresses. That's TWIT1, $100 off select mattresses. This is a great time to transform the way you sleep. We all deserve a good night's sleep. Terms and conditions apply. See casper.com/terms. Casper.com/twit1. Promo code is twit1. You would agree, wouldn't you, Georgia? You've done videos on sleep that you mm-hmm. it's gotta be cool. Don't yeah. you sleep better when it's cool, right?
You sleep better. You'll fall asleep fine if you're warm, but you won't stay asleep really well.
That's
as your
it.
Body temperature kind of drops, it's good to have it like between 17 and 19. And a lot of people, if they find that it's really hot, they're not going to be able to sleep, or they sweat and then they're waking up and your blankets are off and on. And they're really comfortable mattresses. We have one for my dog.
Yeah, you know. You know, so
came with a waffle.
It came with a waffle. Nice.
Came with a little toy waffle.
Chew toy. The anxiety dash videos. There are videos on everything, including getting a better night's sleep. Right? Is the sleep in here?
Sleep.
There's conflict resolution.
Sleep is in there. It's the little baby one.
Oh, sleep like
probably
a
probably further down.
Sleep. Oh, there it is.
There we go. That's the baby.
Get
one.
The sleep you've always dreamt of. Ooh.
Yeah. And the nice thing is that it's like our whenever we deal with people that have insomnia or they come in and they can't sleep, these are the things that I would say in my session to help them get their sleep back on track. And it's the stuff that Sandra would say. So we kind of, you know, sleep is important, and we spend like, you know, 30% of our life on a mattress, or, you know, depending on your sleep habits, maybe more, maybe less.
Well, it's not all sleeping, but yeah, I agree.
Okay, and fair.
Actually, that's the big problem for me is a lot of time spent on the mattress. I'm not sleeping, and I wish I were sleeping. So wide awake looking at the ceiling. No fun. You and Renee Ritchie doing a great new podcast called Apple Talk. Want to get everybody subscribed to that because Renee's got the brains, but you got the heart.
It's a lot of fun. We haven't done a podcast in a really long time together, and so we're really excited. Can I give a little plug to my friend who just started a new service for people that want to kind of get like live with technology but not be engulfed with technology? It's called Navigate. It's Christina Crook with Navigate, and it's this wonderful site. I think that it's Navigate Christina Crook, and it's just this wonderful site that you can subscribe, and she sends things to help you live a more peaceful, happy life and not be kind of sucked into technology, but enjoy it along with still connecting. And I think that we really do need people to be able to connect with each other. So I'm really excited for her. So check that out.
And you don't have to ditch your phone. Okay.
No, it's how you can live with both. You can still watch this podcast, but also have a more full, rich life.
That's so pathetic. I get up in the morning. The first thing I have to do is go to my Animal Crossing island and make sure there's no weeds and find all the fossils and hit all the rocks and shake all the trees. And then an hour later, I get out of bed and I bring my laptop to the breakfast table and I sit down and I look for news for Twitter. I'm in front of a screen all the freaking time.
So maybe someone should get that for you. Subscribe
maybe.
For a few months to be
maybe.
Able to do the balancing.
God.
The Animal Crossing is cute. I get it.
Did you play it ever?
I did play Animal Crossing, yeah. My favorite thing was just getting the different animals.
Yeah.
That was everything for me. But I could get sucked into that kind of game. So
yeah, I don't know what it is. It's The Simpsons tapped out. Before that, it was Wii Rule. Before that, it was Farmville. There's something about farming.
It's so peaceful. It's innate to us to want to hunt, gather, accumulate. Yeah. That's the people that did that better survived, right?
Yeah.
Ants and the grasshoppers.
I discovered that make good money if you raise pumpkins in Animal Crossing. So I basically took over the whole island with pumpkins. It's not good for the residents. It actually teaches you a little bit about capitalism.
It makes you understand the machine better.
Yeah. Screw the residents. I'm growing pumpkins.
Right.
But pretty soon nobody will buy the pumpkins, and then you'll be sorry. All right. Let's talk. I want to actually, this is a big story, and I'm sure that Jason, because you cover media with a lot of your shows, is something you've been kind of aware of. Let's go back in time. The Trump administration fought it for a couple of years, but AT&T wanted to buy Warner Media. And boy, this was a big acquisition, more than $100 billion. And they, and it finally got through. The Trump administration tried to slow it down. Eventually, a judge was convinced by AT&T that nothing bad will happen. So this is, you know, this is following Comcast buying NBC Universal. This has been what's happened, is that Viacom buying CBS, as these channels, the distributors, the delivery companies, the streamers buy content up, and they're just all vying. Eventually, everything will be owned by Verizon, AT&T, you know, Comcast, the big ISPs. So they bought Warner Brothers. They got HBO. They got Turner. They got all sorts of things like DC Comics, which, by the way, the first thing they did was kill Mad Magazine.
It's such a bummer.
God, it just makes me mad.
But
now, then the next thing that happens is that Richard Pepler, who's in charge of HBO and actually widely considered to be a brilliant movie executive, gets forced out by AT&T's, eventually became CEO, John Stankey. And I remember a couple of years ago when Stankey said, and I felt a little chill go up my spine, HBO needs to be more like Netflix.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's in effect what's happened.
Yeah, I loved him on The Little Rascals, by the way. Stanky.
Stanky. He was my favorite. He was the one with the hair that stuck up, right? Yeah.
Everybody is afraid of Netflix's power, right? Everybody in the entertainment industry. And they all want their own Netflix. They all want to be their own Netflix. And everybody took a different path to it. So, like, Disney took their path to it with Disney Plus. And what they wanted to do is Warner Media, driven by AT&T, they wanted to create something where they could pour all of their resources into their own premium streaming service. And in doing so, they took HBO, which was probably their best property, honestly, their best brand. But they said, you can't be HBO anymore. You need to be Netflix. And that led to an exodus of HBO executives.
Pepler is now at Apple, I think, right?
Yeah, Pepler is doing his stuff for Apple TV Plus. Yeah. Which is actually, I would say, maybe the streaming service most like classic HBO in that they're focused on originals. And, you know, meanwhile, HBO Max now, like, they are trying to be Netflix, and Jason Kilar, who's a smart guy who was the founder of Hulu, basically, is running it. And, you know, they're playing a different game. And now with the story I assume we're about to talk about, they've got some content that's really interesting and may actually motivate people to sign up for this service, which apparently so far, most of the people who actually are eligible to get HBO Max have just not bothered to sign up for it.
So, in classic antitrust theory, the way it works is a company becomes bigger and bigger, pushes out all the competition. And one way they do it is by undercutting the competition, selling below cost and so forth. Until the competition is gone, they control everything, and then they raise prices through the roof. I think this is exactly what's happening. Warner Brothers has announced that starting in 2021, I don't think it's going to end, but they're going to release all their new movies, both on HBO Max and in theaters. They'll be on HBO Max for a period of a month. They gave the theater companies 1 hour notice of this, and distributors like AMC and Regal, who are this close to going bankrupt anyway, thanks to COVID-19, are freaked out. It is going to be a huge threat to the future of motion picture theaters.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. It's actually starting Christmas Day, right? Because it's with Wonder Woman 84. And then going on, there'll be a 1 month window where those will be playing not just in theaters, but on HBO Max. And then after a month, it will go to, you know, online sales and rental and Blu-rays and,
by the way,
whatever else.
Not for $20, free on HBO Max.
Yes, and if you get HBO with your cable company, you probably can get HBO Max for free. You just need to sign up.
Yeah.
So, but a lot of people haven't.
If you're a movie theater chain, and you know that Wonder Woman 84 is going to be free for 1 month to HBO Max subscribers, what do you think that's going to do your ticket sales?
Well, their ticket sales are already in the toilet.
Right, but this is all of 2021.
I know.
Look, anybody who thinks that we're going to be seeing, you know, people broadly going back into movie theaters before a year from now, I think is nuts.
There is some hope that with a vaccine, people could be going back this summer. I think saying all of 2021 is a big deal.
I think this summer is ambitious at best. I think we're going to see a very slow and measured rollout of a vaccine. And I think that this is actually probably the only way that HBO could make any of its money back. I understand that theaters are freaked out. You know, there's a whole sidebar we could do on what AT&T has done to DC Comics. But, you know, ultimately, at least for the movies, I don't see any other option. You're sitting on these things which are done. They're in the can. They're waiting to go. and there's not going to be butts in seats at theaters. It's insane. I don't know that I'd even go to a theater that a friend of mine rented out and there were, 15 seats per person. Like, I just don't know that kind of risk is worth it these days. And I think a lot of other people are making a similar calculation, especially with the massive spikes in COVID going on around the world right now. It's not just the U.S. It's everywhere is seeing a resurgence. And I would not go into a theater, bottom line.
So that's the excuse. You know? I feel like really this is Warner Media saying, jumping on that and saying, good, we could put these theaters out of business. AMC's CEO slammed their plan, saying they're going to lose, not AMC, Warner is going to lose a ton of money. This is the statement published by The Hollywood Reporter. Clearly, Warner Media intends to sacrifice a considerable portion of the profitability of its movie studio division and that of its production partners and filmmakers to subsidize its HBO Max startup. I would submit that's exactly what you do if you're a monopoly, you give up profit for a short term in the long term, hoping and what better to be this was, by the way, one of the very first antitrust cases was in the movie companies, which owned all the theaters. Forced to divest the theaters because when you own the production and the distribution, there's no competition. And right. I think this is what Stanky is going for. I love saying that name. I think this is what Stanky is going for. AMC says, we will do all in our power to ensure that Warner does not do this at our expense. We will aggressively pursue economic terms that preserve our business. They said, we made a deal for Wonder Woman 1984 because, well, we knew the theaters wouldn't be reopening by Christmas. But this is all of 2021.
Yeah.
And this is not the deal we made.
Well listen, I don't want to... I'm not a big fan of the movie theater chains either. I think that they have had they're not motivated and have not been motivated for a long time to actually have a good product because they had exclusivity in terms of these windows of time when they're only in theaters. And that may be coming to an end. I think people will still want to go to movie theaters in the long run, but I think that they're going to go for reasons that are not time exclusivity. They're going to be going because they want to be with an audience, because they want to see a big screen, because they want to get food with their movie and like have an experience. It's going to be different. And a lot of these movie theater chains that have theaters that are getting by on a terrible experience, and we've all been in those theaters because it was the only place that you could see the Marvel movie of the week. They're not going to be able to get away with that necessarily. That all said, I do believe, and Seth said it, the whole idea that even if people come back to the theaters over the summer, it's going to be at 40% or 20% or 50%. We don't know. It's not 100%. The big challenge is if you're Warner or Disney, you can't make a movie for $200 or $300 million for streaming. It doesn't. The economics don't work.
Mulan is the proof that was a terrible failure. It was $30 to watch it, and it just tanked. Yeah. They made
the money's the money's not there. People aren't going to pay like they do in the theater. So they're going to be motivated in the long run to have those big tent poles that cost hundreds of millions of dollars, and there's some exclusivity, and they get them into theaters because otherwise the alternative is those $300 million movies are going to not be made anymore, and instead everything's going to be The Mandalorian. Everything's going to be a $100 million Marvel movie that goes directly to Disney Plus. And I think that while we will probably see more of that, I think there will still be a place for the big blockbuster that costs a fortune in the movie theater. But like, how many of those theaters exist, and whether, to your point, Leo, they're all studio owned and operated, or they're things that are more like, some of these special like restaurant movie theater chains that we see,
like Alamo or maybe Alamo Draft House. IMAX.
Exactly.
It's with that. Something
I
that
want
you,
more of an experience. I want something different. Yeah. I want something different. Yeah. I have a nice enough, it's a tiny little projector screen, but I have a nice enough kind of theater in my home. We bought the little home theater movie seats. That's great for me. You can order them. They're cool. Great. They set them up.
Why wouldn't you want a nice couch? Why do you want to sit in a movie theater?
Because they have the little drink holder, and we have a little candy room. And so if we're doing
you're
it for the movie, if you want the couch,
you're recreating
you can do it upstairs. If you want the movie theater, you do the movie theater, but we deck it out. We have
I think
like
that's part of the risk is that people are going to do what you're doing, which is they're going to build home theaters that are
exactly.
great.
Exactly. I want 4D cinema. I want IMAX. I want to, you know, have live actors that we interact with or have a full scale meal like
you want
upper class.
Smell-rama.
Like, I want, yeah, I would.
It's got to be something.
Totally. I want something more than that.
Alamo Draft House, where they bring you a beer and your, you know, your food selection while you're sitting with your friends in a packed theater, all reacting to an exciting movie is a great, that's not going to go away, but the lousy shoebox.
But the little
where
ones are going to have to adapt or die. Right. Which I don't want any company to go under, but if it's not, it hasn't changed with the time, the dinosaurs slowly become extinct and we move for it. But the sad part is I'm not getting this. I'm not going to get to watch this. This is not coming out in Canada. So yeah, I hope you guys enjoy Wonder Woman.
Yeah, actually.
You're not going to be able to download it? There's no streaming for it?
No, it's only going to be streaming. Oh, you mean if you don't have HBO Max?
In countries without HBO Max, that's right now, that's the question.
It's pretty much right now.
So you can't buy it on iTunes. You have
us.
So that's the plan, right? Get everybody to buy HBO Max.
Got it. In the U.S. And then they might have some streaming partners overseas, or they may just wait. But I think the window for the rest of it's going to be really like a month later. So it may be on video in those markets on like January 25th, for example.
But that's making the best of a bad situation, because they know that either they hold on to it till next year, as happened with the James Bond movie. Or if you're going to release it, you have to release it streaming, because nobody's going to go to a movie theater at Christmas.
Right. Some of this may be contractually driven. We don't know what's in the contracts on Wonder Woman 84 and whether they had to get it out before
maybe.
The end of the year.
Yeah,
there may be something related to like that related to the movies that are being that they're releasing on streaming in 2021.
But the other thing we're forgetting is that.
Yeah, they have to pay off their debts.
They have to pay off all the actors and stuff. They actually have to do it structurally, where HBO Max is writing a check to Warner the studio, because they have basically, there are a bunch of actors and directors and stuff who worked on the movie who have a piece of the box office or related to the box office gross, which no longer exists. So they've had to, and now they have presumably to do that with their whole 2021 slate, is like figure out a way to negotiate a rate that is sort of like virtual box office, because that is all they have.
Sure. But we're also forgetting that in especially in terms of video and audio media, that a lot of some of the most popular shows over the past, you know, 10 years, especially Game of Thrones, really hit their mark and blew up their audiences because people were torrenting them in countries where they couldn't stream it. And, you know, I would never encourage anyone to do anything illegal, but torrenting has been around for 20 years. People know how it works. And we've seen that when shows like Game of Thrones get torrented, things that are incredibly popular, they get even more popular. And I would be very surprised if that doesn't wind up having an impact, a positive impact, on people wanting to go see these movies whenever they do get released into theaters, because we know that's going to happen. They're not going to keep a tentpole like Wonder Woman 84 out of the theater once theaters reopen. They're going to have some big, you know, rewatching experience for it. So
in some ways, this might be a positive thing. Theaters stick around for blockbusters. People do want the social experience. But there are great movies like Alfonso Cuarón's Roma, which came out on streaming only on Netflix, that will find an audience. These aren't $100 million movies. These are small artistic movies that might find an audience in streaming that they wouldn't have found otherwise. It could be more diversity in films, just because there's a more diverse platform for films. That wouldn't be a bad outcome.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to be, you know, Alamo Drafthouse closed 41 theaters this year.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to be in the theater business this year anyway.
I wouldn't want to be in any business this year. But, you know, here in San Francisco, we're very blessed. We still have a pretty impressive number of independent theaters. We have small chains like Alamo. We do have a couple of big multiplexes as well. But, you know, I live in the Richmond District, and there are two independent movie theaters here. A short walk away from where I live for both of them. And And it's really remarkable that they've been able to eke out a living, you know, up until 2020. It would be horrible if they closed down, but I can't imagine, you know, just seeing where things are going, that if they can make it into, you know, post-COVID times, then they will see a resurgence, because people will be so excited to go do things. And people, at least here in, you know, in this city and other large cities, love independent movies. They love smaller movies. They love second-run movies. They love it when, you know, Francis Coppola puts out a new cut of Godfather 3. You know, that just happened. I mean, there's all sorts of things that I think are going to be driving people back into theaters.
But that's unique. That's San Francisco. That's New York. That's L.A. That's a few metros. I'm sure that's not important box office wise to the big blockbuster movies. They've got to play.
But for the smaller ones, like the Cuarón movie that you're talking about, Roma, yeah, I'm sure that's a huge deal to them.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
I would do drive-in. I would go back to a drive-in cinema. I think that this is the time for it.
That.
If someone opened it, I would love it.
We have drive-ins down here. I don't know about Montreal because of the weather.
So we don't have any left here.
Yeah.
In SF, we did do that. They did a series of drive-in showings at Fort Mason. I saw Fury Road there, which was great. And, you know, there were a whole bunch of people that I knew who we all bought tickets and drove our cars in. And it was nice to see people socially, even if distanced, for the first time in months. But they got this giant screen LED projection, just brighter than, you know, brighter than almost the sun. I mean, it was just incredible. You know, and people would either, you know, pull in with their hatchbacks or their trucks, or they would, you know, whatever, they tune the radios to it. We had our dogs there. I mean, it was great. It was so much fun. But, you know, so if there's that kind of thing, that would be great. But I think, you know, we're going to see more options coming out in the post-COVID world and not fewer.
Actually, if there's a bigger group of people that are disadvantaged by COVID-19, it's live musicians.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
And there have been, there's some artists who perform in parking lots. Kind of drive-in concerts, but I feel really bad for theater performers, musicians, anybody doing live.
Yeah,
that's tough. That's really.
I want to make
tough.
A plug for a really good book. It's depends on how you're feeling and what your mood is, but there's a book called "A Song for a New Day" by Sarah Pinsker that was one of the Nebula Award nominees, I want to say, from 2019, and it is literally about a pandemic that changes the face of live music performance.
Oh my god!
And how technology is a replacement but not a good replacement for live music, and how people still, after a pandemic, want to be in spaces together. And yeah, her timing wasn't the best because it came out and then the pandemic hit. But it's really a good book.
She was prescient.
If you're into sci-fi and sort of like near future social aspects of things like what we're living through, Sarah Pinsker, Song for a New Day, it's really good. Good book. Just a little bit of a downer given what we're going through
Alexis,
right now. But yeah, it'll all come back, but it will be different. I think that's the lesson, right? Is that what comes back won't be what was there in 19. It'll be a new thing.
Yeah. Alexis Ohanian, who started Reddit and is married to Serena Williams and is now a VC, is an investor in a company. I got talked into buying in on this, called ODA, ODA.co. They send you speakers, and on a Saturday night, you just turn on the speakers because they're going to have a live concert brought to your home over these speakers. And there's, I think, a subscription fee. They do quarterly seasons, and they do series. And I guess for a lot of live musicians, this is their best hope. But here we are sitting in our house, listening to a live performance.
My local theater did a streaming Zoom-based theater experience that was adapted from a regular play, but turned into a streaming thing. And it was really good. It was a lot of fun. And like, there was audience participation. We had to vote on some stuff that got picked up by the actors. And I think that, nice. You know, it's no substitute for the real thing, but if you can't have the real thing, like to see the creativity.
Got to do something. Yeah.
Yeah, I did a VR theater experience. It was actually quite nice.
Really?
Quite a lot of fun. Yeah.
But you have to wear that visor.
You know what? If you've been doing it for a while,
you
if
built up the
games, it's
immunity.
Not really, yeah, your neck.
Do you have a callus on your forehead?
My neck will just become really thick.
Well, actually, but you could lie on your back, right? It doesn't. You don't have to sit up.
Well, yes, because when you lie back, and depending on which version you're using,
suddenly looking
you're
lying at the ceiling.
You're looking at the ceiling, right? So, so it's not really going to work. Oh. But it was kind of cool. You see people and they're next to you, and it's this weird feeling because now being next to, even when I watch things on shows and I discuss it, is when I watch people in shows and they're doing this dance scene and it's this sweaty, hot dance area that I used to be like, oh, I can't, would love to go there and just dance until I drop. And now I'm like, oh, all the sweating and heavy breathing and like you can see everyone spinning. Like you're like, no, this is horrible. So even the way that I look at other people interacting, it's different.
All right. We're going to have to run through about 100 stories because we've been enjoying the conversation so much. I've got a backlog. We're going to do a kind of a speed round when we come back and then wrap this puppy up. It's, you know, when I have a great panel, sometimes the show goes long, and that's what happened today. Really good conversation. I do want to show you, though, and you can avert your eyes, Georgia, because this is not for you. Actually, it might be. It's for the man in your life. I want to show you my Manscaped performance package. I think just because we are quarantined doesn't mean we have to look like a Sasquatch. Jeez. I guess is my point of view. This is the this is the Manscaped performance package. Let me tell you, this is going to be the holiday gift for 2020 because so many people have been stuck inside. And guys, let's face it. Our grooming kind of goes downhill, right? You know, you don't need to fix yourself up so much. This is the men's hygiene bundle that makes for a perfect gift. Included, you get the Weed Whacker, which is their ear and nose hair trimmer. There is nothing worse than I had a friend that had a forest growing out of his nose, young guy too, you know, his 40s, young for me. And I every time I'm talking to the guy, I'm looking at him and I can't stop staring at his nostrils because there's so this. Don't let that happen to you. Don't have hair come. I see you. I see you nodding, Georgia. You don't want hair coming out of your ears. The Weed Whacker is waterproof. It has a 9,000 RPM motor and a 360-degree rotary dual blade system. The high speed's good because it means no nicking, no pulling. 79% of partners polled admitted long nose hair is a major turnoff, and this is the best tool for the job. And by the way, when you get the performance package, you'll also get a subscription to replacement blades every 3 months, so you always have a nice sharp blade on your weed whacker. This is the lawnmower. This is awesome, too. Look how quiet this is. This is a high-speed ceramic blade. Look, there's a little LED light, so you're never in mystery about what you're, where you're navigating. In, you know, my friend Micah Sargent says that the best example is you'll trim your hedges to make the house look bigger. You know what I'm saying? This is all about keeping the lawnmower 3.0, my friends. The dads can't stop talking about it. The teens secretly buy it. And the people in our lives will love you. For it is the season to get Manscaped. Get the Manscaped Performance Package. It also includes their famous liquid formulations, the Crop Preserver to keep your nether regions smelling fresh, and the Crop Reviver. I don't know if you have a nether region hygiene routine, but if you did, it would be definitely, it would definitely involve the Crop Reviver. And you get two free gifts. You get your Manscaped boxers. And it all comes with this wonderful shed travel bag. The performance package is the best value Manscaped has ever offered. It's hot off the shelves. Plus, you're going to get 20% off because you're listening to this show and free shipping. This is the holiday gift that will make your loved ones smile and look and smell better. Free shipping, 20% off, manscaped.com/twit. Make Santa proud this year. Get 20% off plus free shipping. manscaped.com/twit. Maybe your wife should, check it out.
The LED light on the razor is cool. That's neat.
It's very bright.
It's important. It's important to be able to see what you're shaving.
You might get some good ideas. It also comes with what I thought was a newspaper. the Manscaped Daily News. But actually, what it is you spread it out to catch the remnants. But they do have some good suggestions for how you might want to
diagrams.
Just, you know,
is there a flow chart?
There's a flow chart. Serving suggestions. There's also a crossword puzzle. I do not recommend doing the crossword puzzle while you manscape. That's just not a good idea.
I don't know, Leo. This is kind of nuts.
Oh, I got that. Very nice. Well done.
Sorry. It's late in the day. That's all I can handle.
See what he did there, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, speed round, because we got to go through. There's a ton of these, and there were so many big stories this week. I don't even know how to get through them all. Arguments in front of the U.S. Supreme Court on the CFAA, the 1986 law that has been used to prosecute everybody from Aaron Swartz on down. I mean, it's just a nasty, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. The case is involving a Georgia police officer convicted of violating the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act by accessing a license plate database. The good news is the justices seem to come down on the side of privacy. Neil Gorsuch said that this was an example of the government trying to broaden the scope of criminal laws in contestable ways. The DOJ's argument risked, quote, making a federal criminal of us all. And I think if you remember, I mean, poor Aaron Swartz, who was prosecuted under the CFAA and eventually committed suicide because of it, it's a perfect example of overreach. And we've seen this time and time again, the feds using the CFAA in ways that clearly isn't intended. I presume you agree, Seth, on this, that this is a problematic law.
So the CFA is everybody I speak with says it's overly broad.
Yeah.
There's almost unanimous agreement, no matter what perspective somebody is coming to it from, on that. This is actually the first time in its entire existence that it's gone before the Supreme Court. So this is a really sort of unique moment for the preeminent anti-hacking law in the U.S.
Good. We'll watch.
I would hesitate, despite what, you know, the questions were and what the justices said. I would hesitate to read too much into them. We've seen
you could never tell.
Time and again. But it's interesting, and I think it's going to be very important to see what happens to to this case.
The president has attempted to tie a repeal of Section 230 to the Defense Spending Act. Actually, this is the time of year where Congress does this, where they've got big spending bills that need to be passed, and it's a great way to sneak something by. We'll see what happens, but he said, I'll veto it unless you have a repeal of Section 230. And, of course, the National Defense Authorization Act should not be vetoed. It is pretty important.
I think it would be very interesting for the anti-war folks to find
to find
that Trump is the one who defunded the Pentagon.
Wouldn't that be
ironic?
But,
you know, weirder things have happened with this guy. So, I don't think that's
going to happen.
I don't think that 230 is going away.
Well, and remember, Friday was the day TikTok was supposed to go out of business. TikTok a couple of weeks ago said, guys, what's up? Because we just need to know. Apparently the administration said, look, we're not going to enforce it. Keep negotiating. And then I think 50 days from now, it'll just magically disappear. I don't know. Very strange. Ajit Pai, 50 days from now, January 20th, will be...
He will also mysteriously disappear.
Mysteriously disappear. Now, he's the chairman of the FCC. I don't remember what... Typically, a president appoints a new chairman anyway. But I guess Ajit Pai wanted to keep the news cycle and say, "Well,
he
I'm leaving.
To leave.
I'm quitting.
He
you can't
to leave,
fire me.
Not get fired.
Yeah, you can't fire me. I quit.
You didn't dump me. I dump you."
We will watch with interest because my suspicion is he's already got a job at Verizon and he's just ready to packing his briefcase ready to move on. Let's see what else. Big pressure on a BuzzFeed, and this actually is a BuzzFeed article, which is also in violation of ICE's request. ICE is demanding that BuzzFeed divulge its sources on a story about immigration. And, of course, BuzzFeed protects its sources, as all good journalistic enterprises do. ICE even said, not only do we want you to divulge your sources, but you can't tell anybody that we're asking for this. So, of course, BuzzFeed immediately published the story. Needless to say, it's important that journalists can do their job without repercussions. David Snyder is a lawyer and executive director of the nonprofit First Amendment Coalition, said, I think this is the best description. If journalists had to divulge sources of information, sources or information they obtained in the course of reporting, they'd be no better than the investigative arm of the state. The power of journalism to advance the cause of our democracy would be severely diminished. So this is just more of the same. I presume BuzzFeed will continue to say, yeah, no. And at some point this may end up in court, but I would hope a judge would be smart enough to protect the First Amendment. That is a pretty important part of the Constitution. Let's see. It looks like the Chinese have had a breakthrough in quantum computing. They are now, remember, it was Google this year who said, we have, what do they call that? The quantum singularity, where we finally have a quantum computer that it can do a calculation the main, you know, a supercomputer would take hundreds of years to do in mere seconds. This is a big breakthrough, a second breakthrough in quantum computing. I don't feel like we're that close to quantum computing suddenly taking over the world. But they are making some progress, and now it's the Chinese turn to quantum supremacy.
Yeah, that's it. Right. Mm-hmm. And the idea of quantum supremacy is literally, theoretically, is great, but like, can you actually build something that can do something that a regular computer cannot do?
Right.
Also, you should sign up for Bloomberg's newsletter.
yes, you saw that pop up. Even though I already pay Bloomberg a ton of money for access to
their... It doesn't ever stop. They just repurpose their you should pay us to a you should subscribe to our newsletter give it as a gift or tell a friend. Anyway, quantum supremacy. Yeah, the idea that you could really build something that a normal computer couldn't do. And China says... This research group says they did something in minutes that would take a normal computer 2 billion years to do, which is a long time, longer than we've had computers. Yeah, if it's true, that's awesome.
The problem is, what was that thing that we're able to do? Was it of any value at all?
It was decrypting all of our emails.
Oh, okay, good. Probably. Nice. 100 trillion times faster than the world's most advanced supercomputer. It's a very difficult thing to do, and it's not very reliable yet. But hey, it might happen. Look, I mean, they came up with a COVID vaccine in under a year. That's unheard of, thanks to modern mRNA technologies. Oh, this is a sad one. I'm going to end with a sound bite from Puerto Rico. This is the Arecibo Observatory. Yeah. You remember a couple of weeks ago, we talked about the fact that it had been damaged in the hurricanes of Puerto Rico and the storms, and that the towers, they were concerned were going to fall, so they were going to demolish them before they could fall and damage the dish beneath it. They were unable to do so, and a few days ago, here's video from Arecibo, it collapsed. Let me turn up the sound, because I know you're not getting it. Into the dish. Fortunately, there were no humans around. They were really concerned the visitor center is below it and so forth. But that's the end of a telescope that has operated for, I think, close to 60 years. It was part of the SETI at home.
Was once the largest radio telescope in the world. It's now, it was the second, I think, largest radio telescope, and has been used for all sorts of things, including, SETI, Contact, the movie with Jodie Foster. There's a bunch of early scenes that are set there because that was definitely a place that SETI used. And it's a real tragedy, not just for radio astronomy, but the whole astronomical community. So many of them astronomers, you know, have fond memories of going to Puerto Rico and going to Arecibo, which is sort of like way out in the, you know, far away from the main parts of Puerto Rico. And it's like a, there's a little village that's grown up around there for where the, all the astronomers are. And like, it's a point of pride in Puerto Rico. And it's, you know, it was already kind of broken and not going to come back, but now it's been completely destroyed. It's really tragic.
The second video is from a drone, which I guess they, with some foresight, had above the observation platform. And boy, it's dramatic to watch those cables snap and the whole thing tumble down.
They knew it was happening, right? They were trying to do a controlled demolition so that they would be able to figure out exactly where to drop it. And it beat them to it.
Yep. Okay. Sad. Let's see. If you want to go to Singapore, you can have chicken nuggets grown in a vat. This is the first time ever lab-grown meat has gone on sale. It's a single restaurant in Singapore that's selling it. The chicken bites are produced by a U.S. company called Eat Just. You may be aware of them. They have vegan mayonnaise and stuff in the stores. But there are dozens of firms trying to figure out how to grow chicken, beef, and pork in a vat to avoid killing animals. Vegetarians will be thrilled. And one of the things, you know, it's good for the environment. It's good for your health. But one of the things that stops people like me from being a vegetarian is I like the taste of meat. So now they can use a few cells of a chicken, feed it plant proteins, grow it in a 1,200-liter bioreactor, and serve it in a restaurant in Singapore. I would like to taste these, but I'm not going to fly to Singapore to do it.
I would try them. Maybe not one of the first people to try it.
No, it's like the vaccine.
I've watched all the a few people try it out before me, and I'll see how it goes, but I'd try it.
It can't be, you know, more artificial than a real chicken nugget, right? Like,
I don't think there's any chicken in a chicken nugget. So, yeah.
It's pretty artificial already.
Yeah.
Can't be any worse.
All right. So that's, I think it's going to be, they think maybe by 2040, in the next 20 years, most meat will come from a vat because as they grow it and they scale up, it can get cheaper and cheaper. Right now, it's fairly expensive, but so was the Impossible Burger. And now they're selling it at White Castle. So, the difference is an Impossible Burger is plant protein. It's not an animal protein. It's just a burger-like experience. This would be actual meat, but just not made by an animal. So I guess you could argue that it's not really meat. I don't know. I don't know. All right. I think we should wrap this up. There are still many, many stories I didn't get to. These things happen. I thank you for being here. Great panel. Jason Snell is sixcolors.com with Dan Morin. But also, we really should plug the incomparable, all the podcasts you do on the
all the great podcasts.
Relay FM Network.
I've been doing a series. It's at Six Colors, and there's a podcast on Relay FM called 20 Max for 2020, which are little audio documentaries and essays and little videos about what I think are the 20 most notable Macs in history, counting down from 20 to number one. Tomorrow we'll be at number four. So people should check those out. And the podcast, I'm really proud of, the podcast especially, which is on Relay.fm.
I've had every one of these, I think. So have you.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, they're good. That's they're notable. Many of them are actually bad, but they're notable for how bad they were, like the Macintosh Portable or the 20th anniversary Macintosh. Yeah. It's not the best Macs. It's the most interesting or notable Macs.
I got the Macintosh Portables over there. I think we gave away, didn't we, John, the 20th anniversary Macintosh? We gave that away. That's how bad it was.
Yeah, it's a prototype that escaped the lab. But I actually bought a Mac Portable for this project, and it's ridiculously heavy. But the keyboard's great, but it's ridiculous.
You should have just come to visit me. I got one right over there. It's the one with the trackball in the thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
On the side.
On the side. Oh, that one. That one's like 30 pounds. That's huge,
It weighs a ton.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, it was the sewing machine Mac. Yeah. Well, that's fun. 20 Max for 2020 with Jason Snell. Yet another podcast.
It's like an NPR style podcast. It's like super edited and I scripted, and I've got a bunch of interviews with people who know and care about old Macs and stuff. And it's a lot of fun. And they're all like 15 minutes long. They're all super short.
I'm really curious because I feel like, you know, obviously this is the opposite of an NPR podcast. It's not edited. It's sprawling. It goes on and on. It's a mess. But that's what I've always done for 15 years. And I look at the success of the NPR style, and I wonder, well, maybe we should do it that way. Is it a lot of work?
Oh, yeah, it's a lot of work. It's about the most work of the entire project has been doing that podcast. Edit. But it was a great creative challenge. And and I'm using Descript, which, if you haven't heard about it, is basically you feed audio files into this thing and it transcribes them. And then you edit it like you're editing a Word document. And audio comes out the other
Oh, are you using literally, that? Yeah, that's a really interesting product. I've been very interested in that.
Yeah,
so that made it possible?
Well. Yeah, otherwise it would have killed me. But that made it possible. And then you can export. The beauty of Descript is that you can export it out into any popular editing software in project form.
So you can clean
it
up.
So I take it out to Logic and then I clean it up and add music and stuff like that. But that way I can literally use my editorial skills as a writer and an editor to look at my interviews and move quotes around and stuff and build a script out of that. And that's what's enabled me to do it. It's pretty amazing technology.
Yeah, that's interesting. So it helps you get it to kind of the first pass. Would you say 80, 90% there?
Yeah, I'd say 90%. It's pretty close. And now they've got a video version or video features too. So anybody who's doing like a documentary where you've got hours and hours of interviews to go through, can you imagine? All you have to do is edit the text of your interview and you've got video at the end
of
it.
It's brilliant.
Wow.
I like what you're saying because I never trust it to do it by itself. But I like what you're saying is you get the Logic project and then you tweak it a little bit, make sure
that
it's
just
right.
That was the moment for me was when I knew I could take it out. I mean, they have a rudimentary editor in the app, but you can just take it out and then use your video editor or your audio editor to
fancy
do the fine tuning. Yeah. But it's pretty amazing. You remove one word and then you play it and that word is just gone. It's pretty cool.
Wow.
Pretty soon we won't even have to do these shows. We'll just just do a tweet.
Computers will talk to each other.
Computer, just do a tweet. Right. Yeah. Thank you to the wonderful Georgia Dow. You are a sunshine on a cloudy day. Thank you for being here. Everybody should go to anxiety-videos.com. If you are struggling a little bit and you want some advice, Georgia@westmounttherapy.com. She maybe can steer you in the right direction. Thank you for being here, Georgia. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Yes. And to Seth Rosenblatt, Wolverine, basically, minus the adamantium claws. He's good. Yes.
Well, he might have them. We don't know.
It's going to happen. It could happen. He is, of course, the editor-in-chief at the-parallax.com, covering security primarily, right?
Yep.
And
privacy.
Privacy, of course, they go hand in hand. At Seth R. on the Twitter. Anything you want to plug? You got a podcast you're doing? Anything like that?
I don't. I do have some news that I'm going to hold off on because I'm just not quite ready for it. But we are going to be making some interesting announcements very shortly. And I'm sure I'll see you again soon thereafter.
Would the best thing to do be to go to the Parallax and just follow you there and see what's going on?
No, the best thing would be to send me a check. But the second best thing would be to go to the Parallax and
I'll send you an LED lit clipper.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure. Why not? But also sign up for the newsletter.
Newsletter. That's the place.
Yeah.
Yep. THE-Parallax, PARALAX.com. We do Twit every Sunday afternoon. It's right after the Tech Guys. It's about 2:30 Pacific, 5:30 Eastern time, 22:30 UTC. If you want to watch us do it live or listen live, the streams are at twit.tv/live. If you're consuming it live, you should probably join us in the chat room. That's where a bunch of other people watching live are chatting, irc.twit.tv. Some of the best people there. They're really, really fun bunch. On-demand versions of the show, all of our shows available at our website, twit.tv. There's a YouTube channel for This Week in Tech. You can also subscribe in your favorite podcast application. That'd probably be the best way because then you're going to get it the minute it's available of a Sunday evening or Monday morning, just in time for your commute. Thank you, everybody. We really appreciate your being here.
Thanks, Leo.
Dress up your place next time. I want to be seeing you all with your holly and your boughs of evergreen. Another
this
twit.
Is amazing.
Doing the twit.